This is Audible.
Thomas Nelson Word presents Becoming a Person of Influence by John C. Maxwell and Jim Dornan, narrated by the authors.
How can you make the change from successful individual to effective leader, team builder, and positive change agent? How can you reach out to people while reaching your maximum potential? No matter what your goals, building an organization, raising a family, improving your community or other worthwhile desires, you can achieve them by learning to positively influence people. Authors John C. Maxwell, founder of Enjoy, and Jim Dornan, president and owner of Network 21 International, have spent most of their lives raising up influencers and have positively impacted the lives of millions of people worldwide. With humor, heart, and unique insight, they share what they've gleaned from decades of experience. Whatever your vocation or aspiration, listen now as John C. Maxwell and Jim Dornan teach you how you can increase your positive impact on others by becoming a person of influence.
When John and I met a few years ago, we sensed instantly that there was great chemistry between us, almost like that of brothers. We had so much in common.
Yes, we did, despite our very different backgrounds. Jim, you spent the last 30 years in the business environment teaching people how to become successful. And in the process, you built a worldwide business organization.
Yeah, and John, you've spent the last 28 years working in the nonprofit environment as a pastor, denominational executive, and motivational speaker. You're recognized as one of the top equippers in the United States in leadership and personal growth development.
What we have in common, Jim, is an understanding of people and of the positive impact that one person's life can have on others. And it all boils down to one idea: influence. We know the power of influence, and we want to share it with you.
So please join us and continue listening. We're going to give you many of our insights, tell some entertaining stories, and share dynamite principles that have the power to change your life and the lives of all the people you can influence.
When you were a child, what did you want to be when you grew up? Did you dream about being a famous actor or singer? How about President of the United States? Maybe you wanted to become an Olympic athlete or one of the wealthiest people in the world. We all have dreams and ambitions. Undoubtedly, you've accomplished some of yours. But no matter how successful you are now, you still have dreams and goals that are waiting to be fulfilled. And our desire is to help you realize those dreams, to help you realize your potential. Let's start by doing a little experiment. Listen to the following list of people. It's quite a diverse group, but they all have one thing in common. See if you can figure out what it is. John Grisham, George Gallup, Robert E. Lee, Dennis Rodman, James Dobson, Dan Rather, Madonna, Hideo Nomo, Jerry and Patty Beaumont, Rich DeVos, Mother Teresa, Pablo Picasso, Adolf Hitler, Tiger Woods, Glenn Leatherwood, Bill Clinton, John Wesley, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Have you figured out what all of them have in common? The answer is, every one of them is a person of influence.
We created this list almost at random, selecting well-known people as well as ones from our own lives. We did it to make this point. Everyone is an influencer of other people. It doesn't matter who you are or what your occupation is. A politician, such as President of the United States, has tremendous influence on hundreds of millions of people, not only in his own country but around the globe. And entertainers, such as Madonna and Arnold Schwarzenegger, often influence an entire generation. A teacher such as Glenn Leatherwood, who instructed John and hundreds of other boys in Sunday school, touches the lives of not only his own students, but also indirectly influences all the people those boys grow up to influence. But you don't have to be in a high-profile occupation to be a person of influence. In fact, if your life in any way connects with other people, you are an influencer. Everything you do at home, at church, in your job, or on the ball field has an impact on the lives of other people. As American poet, philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson said, every man is a hero and an oracle to somebody, and to that person, whatever he says has an enhanced value.
If you desire to be successful or to make a positive impact on your world, you need to become a person of influence. Without influence, there is no success. For example, if you're a salesperson wanting to sell more of your product, you need to be able to influence your customers. If you're a manager, your success depends on your ability to influence your employees. If you coach, you can only build a winning team if you can influence your players. If you're a pastor, your ability to reach people and grow your church depends on your influence with your congregation. If you want to raise a strong, healthy family, you have to be able to influence your children in a positive way. No matter what your goals are in life, you can achieve them faster, you can be more effective, and your contribution can be longer lasting if you learn how to become a person of influence.
Influence doesn't come to us instantaneously. Instead, it grows by stages. Visually, it looks like a series of four stair steps. The bottom step is modeling. People are first influenced by what they see. If you have children, then you've probably observed this. No matter what you tell your children to do, their natural inclination is to follow what they see you doing. For most people, if they perceive that you are positive and trustworthy and have admirable qualities, then they will seek you as an influencer in their lives. And the better they get to know you, the greater your credibility will be and the higher your influence can become if they like what they see. Modeling can be a powerful influence, either positively or negatively, and it's something that can be done even from a distance. But if you want to make a really significant impact on the life of other people, you've got to do it from up close. And that brings you to the second level of influence, which is motivation. You become a motivational influencer when you begin to encourage people and communicate with them on an emotional level. The process does two things. It creates a bridge between you and them, and it builds up their confidence and sense of self-worth. When people feel good about you and themselves when they're with you, then your level of influence increases significantly.
When you reach the motivational level of influence with others, you can start to see a positive impact in their lives. To increase that impact and make it long-lasting, you've got to move up to the third level of influence, which is mentoring. Mentoring is pouring your life into another person and helping him reach his potential. The power of mentoring is so strong that you can see the life of the person that you are influencing literally changing before your eyes. As you give of yourself, helping him overcome obstacles in his life and showing him how to grow personally and professionally, you help him achieve a whole new level of living. You can truly make a difference in his life. The fourth and highest level is multiplication. As a multiplying influencer, you help the people you're influencing to become positive influencers in the lives of others and pass on not only what they have received from you, but what they have learned and gleaned on their own. Few people ever make it to the fourth level of influence, but everyone has the potential to do so. It takes unselfishness, generosity, and commitment. It also takes time.
As you move up to the higher levels of influence and become an active influencer, you can begin to have a positive influence on people and add value to their lives. That's true for any positive influencer. The babysitter who reads to a child encourages him to love books and become a lifelong learner. The teacher who puts his faith, confidence, and love in a little girl helps her to feel valued and good about herself. The boss who delegates to her employees and gives them authority as well as responsibility enlarges their horizons and empowers them to become better workers and people. The parents who know how and when to give their children grace help them to stay open and communicative even during their teenage years. All of these people add lasting value to the lives of others. We don't know what kind of influence you have on others today as you listen to this. Your actions may touch the lives of thousands of people, or you may be influencing two or three coworkers or family members. The number of people is not what's most important. The crucial thing to remember is that your level of influence is not static. Even if you've had a negative effect on others in the past, you can turn that around and make your impact a positive one. And if your level of influence has been relatively low up till now, you can increase it and become a person of influence who helps others. In fact, that's why we're talking with you now. We want to help you become a person of high influence. No matter what stage of life you're in or what you do for a living, you can have an incredibly positive impact on the lives of other people. You can add tremendous value to their lives.
Let's talk about who's on the influence list. Everyone could sit down and make a list of people who have added value to their lives. We mentioned that the list at the beginning of this chapter contains the names of some of the people who have influenced us. Some of the names are big. For example, I consider 18th century evangelist John Wesley to be one of the greatest influencers of my life and career. Wesley was a great leader, preacher, and social critic. During his lifetime, he turned the Christian church in England and America upside down, and his thoughts and teachings continue to influence the way churches function and Christians believe, even today. I consider Wesley to be the greatest person to have lived since the Apostle Paul. Other people whose names are on that list are not well known, but that in no way lessens their level of influence. For example, two people listed are Jerry and Patty Beaumont, a couple who had a profound impact on the lives of Jim and his wife Nancy. Here's their story.
Nancy and I first met Jerry and Patty almost 25 years ago when Nancy and Patty were both pregnant. The Beaumonts were a classy couple, really sharp and confident. We were attracted to them immediately because it seemed like they really had their life together, and we observed that they were living out their strong spiritual convictions with integrity and consistency. Nancy met Patty one day while they were waiting together in the obstetrician's waiting room. They hit it off instantly and began to build a relationship. We had no idea how much their friendship was going to mean to us just a few months later when our lives got turned upside down. After 9 months of routine pregnancy, Nancy gave birth to our first son, Eric. Well, at first everything appeared to be normal, but a few hours later the doctors discovered that Eric had been born with some very serious physical problems. His back was open and his spinal cord had not formed properly. They told us that he had a condition called spina bifida. To make things worse, his spinal fluid had gotten infected during the delivery, so he was suffering from severe systemic meningitis. Our whole life seemed to be thrown into chaos. After Nancy's hours of labor, we were exhausted, confused, and they told us Eric needed brain surgery. We had to make a decision right then. Without it, he didn't stand a chance, and even with it, things didn't look very good. We cried as they prepared to take our little boy, only a few hours old, and transport him to Children's Hospital for emergency brain surgery. All we could do was pray that he would make it. We waited for hours, but the doctors finally came out and told us Eric was going to live. We were shaken when we first saw him after the surgery. We wondered how someone so small could have so many wires attached to him. The opening in his back was now closed, but we could see that they had surgically implanted a shunt tube in his brain to drain off excess spinal fluid and relieve the pressure. The first year of Eric's life was a blur for us as he repeatedly re-entered Children's Hospital. In the first 9 months, he underwent 11 more surgeries. Three of those operations came in one weekend. Things were happening so fast that we were overwhelmed and we couldn't even comprehend what we might have to face in the future. While we were trying to survive the midnight trips to the hospital and hold up under the pain and fear we had for Eric, guess who came alongside us and helped us survive each day as it came? Jerry and Patty Beaumont. They had come to the hospital that first day of Eric's life and given us comfort and encouragement while he was in the operating room. They brought food for us and sat with Nancy and me in hospital waiting rooms, and all the while they shared their incredible faith with us. Most importantly, they helped us to believe that God had a special plan for Eric and us. You know, Patty told Nancy one day, you and Jim can make Eric's problems the center of everything you do, or you can use them as a launching pad for a whole new way of looking at life. It was then that we turned a corner in our lives. We began looking beyond our circumstances and saw that there was a bigger picture. We realized God had a plan for us as well as Eric, and our faith gave us strength and peace. The Beaumonts had helped us consider and answer some of life's most important questions. From that day on, our entire attitudes changed, and we had great hope.
That was over two decades ago. Jim and Nancy lost touch with the Beaumonts, though they have since tried to find them. Now Eric has grown up and gets around pretty well in his electric wheelchair, despite having experienced a stroke during one of his surgeries. He's a constant source of joy, inspiration, and humor for the Dornan family. And though their contact with Jerry and Patty Beaumont lasted only about a year, Jim and Nancy recognized the tremendous value they added to them and still consider them to be two of the greatest influencers in their lives. Today, Jim and Nancy are themselves people of great influence. Their business has expanded into more than 26 countries around the world, from Eastern Europe to the Pacific, from Brazil and Argentina to mainland China. Through seminars, tapes, and videos, they impact hundreds of thousands of individuals and families each year, and their business continues to grow. But more important to them, they are sharing their strong values and faith with people that they influence. They are doing all they can to add value to the lives of everyone they touch. We don't know exactly what your dream is in life or what kind of legacy you want to leave. But if you want to make an impact, you will have to become a man or woman capable of influencing others. There is no other way to effectively touch people's lives. And if you do become a person of influence, then maybe someday when other people write down the names of those who made a difference in their lives, your name just might be on that list.
Chapter 1. A Person of Influence Has Integrity with People. A few years ago, while my wife Nancy and I were on a business trip to Europe, we celebrated her birthday in London. As her gift, I decided to take her to the Escada boutique to buy her an outfit or two. She tried on a number of things and liked all of them. And while she was in the dressing room trying to decide which one to pick, I told the salesperson to wrap up the whole lot. Nancy tried to protest. She was embarrassed to buy so many things at one time, but I insisted. We both knew she'd get good use out of the clothes. Besides, she looked fabulous in everything. A couple of days later, we took a long flight out of Heathrow Airport in London to San Francisco International. After we landed, we got in line for the inevitable customs check. When they asked what we had to declare, we told them about the clothes Nancy had bought and the amount we had spent. "What?" the agent said. "You're declaring clothes?" He read the figure that we had written down and said, "You've got to be kidding." It's true that we had spent a little bit of money on them, but we didn't think it was that big a deal. "What are the clothes made of?" he asked. That seemed like an odd question. "A bunch of different things," answered Nancy. "Wool, cotton, silk, everything's different. There are dresses, coats, blouses, shoes, belts, accessories. Why?" "Each kind of fabric has a different duty," he said. "I'll have to get my supervisor. I don't even know what all the different rates are. Nobody declares clothes." He looked frustrated. "Go ahead and pull everything out and sort it out according to what it's made of." It must have taken us a good 45 minutes to sort everything out and tally up how much we'd spent on each type of item. The duty turned out to be quite a bit, a couple of thousand dollars. As we were putting everything back into our suitcase, the agent said, "You know what? I think I know you. Aren't you Jim Dornan?" "Yeah," I answered. "I'm sorry, have we met before?" I didn't recognize him. "No," he said, "but I've got a friend who's in your organization, Network 21, right?" "That's right," I said. "I've seen your picture before." "You know," the agent said, "my friend's been telling me that I'd really benefit from hooking up with your organization, but I haven't really listened. Now I'm thinking I should reconsider. He might be right after all. See, most people I see every day try to get all kinds of things through customs without paying duty, even stuff they should know better about. But you guys, you're declaring stuff you could have gotten through with no problem. That's sure a lot of money you could have saved." "That may be true," answered Nancy, "but I can spare the money for customs a lot more than I can spare not having a clear conscience." As we stood in line that day, it didn't even occur to Nancy or me that anyone there might know us. If our intention had been to cheat our way through, we never would have suspected that we'd be recognized. We thought we were anonymous. And I think that is what a lot of people think as they cut corners in life. "Who will ever know?" they say to themselves. But the truth is that other people know. Your spouse, children, friends, business associates all know. And more importantly, even if you cover your tracks really well and they don't know what you're up to, you do. And you don't want to give away or sell your integrity for any price.
Jim's experience with a customs agent is just one small example of how people today think when it comes to integrity. Sadly, it no longer appears to be the norm, and when confronted by an example of honest character in action, many people seem shocked. Common decency is no longer common. Genuine integrity is not for sale. You can see character issues coming up in every aspect of life. A few years ago, for example, financier Ivan Boesky openly described greed as a good thing while speaking at UCLA's business school. That kind of flawed thinking soon got him into trouble. When his unethical practices on Wall Street came to light, he was fined $100 million and sent to prison for 3 years. Recently, he was reported to be ruined financially and living on alimony from his former wife. Government hasn't been immune to integrity issues either. The Department of Justice says it is prosecuting public officials as never before, and it recently boasted that it had convicted over 1,100 in 1 year. A dubious record. TV preachers fall morally. Mothers drown their own children. Professional athletes are found in hotel rooms with drugs and prostitutes. The list keeps growing. It seems that many people look at integrity as an outdated idea, something expendable, or no longer applicable to them in our fast-paced world. But the need for integrity today is perhaps as great as it has ever been, and it is absolutely essential for anyone who desires to become a person of influence.
Cheryl Beal says, one of the realities of life is that if you can't trust a person at all points, you can't truly trust him or her at any point. That's why it's crucial to maintain integrity by taking care of the little things. Many people misunderstand that. They think they can do whatever they want when it comes to the small things because they believe as long as they don't have any major lapses, they're doing well. Well, that's not the way it works. Webster's New Universal Unabridged Dictionary describes integrity as adherence to moral and ethical principles, soundness of moral character, honesty. Ethical principles are not flexible. A little white lie is still a lie. Theft is theft, whether it's $1, $1,000, or $1 million. Integrity commits itself to character over personal gain, to people over things, to service over power, to principle over convenience, to the long view over the immediate. 19th century clergyman Phillips Brooks said, "Character is made in the small moments of our lives." Anytime you break a moral principle, you create a small crack in the foundation of your integrity. And when times get tough, it becomes harder to act with integrity, not easier. Character isn't created in a crisis, it only comes to light. Everything you have done in the past and the things you have neglected to do come to a head when you're under pressure.
Integrity is your best friend. The great 19th century American writer Nathaniel Hawthorne said, "No man can for any considerable time wear one face to himself and another to the multitude without finally getting bewildered as to which is the true one." Anytime you compromise your integrity, you do yourself an incredible amount of damage. That's because integrity really is your best friend. It will never betray you or put you in a compromising position. It helps keep your priorities right. When you're tempted to take shortcuts, it helps you stay the right course. Abraham Lincoln once said, "When I lay down the reins of this administration, I want to have one friend left, and that friend is inside myself." You could almost say that Lincoln's integrity was his best friend while he was in office, because he was criticized so viciously. Here is a description of what he faced as explained by Donald T. Phillips. Abraham Lincoln was slandered, libeled, and hated perhaps more intensely than any man ever to run for the nation's highest office. He was publicly called just about every name imaginable by the press of the day, including a grotesque baboon, a third-rate country lawyer who once split rails and now splits the Union, a coarse, vulgar joker, a dictator, an ape, a buffoon, and other names. The Illinois State Register labeled him the craftiest and most dishonest politician that ever disgraced an office in America. Severe and unjust criticism did not subside after Lincoln took the oath of office, nor did it come only from Southern sympathizers. It came from within the Union itself, from Congress, from some factions within the Republican Party, and initially from within his own cabinet. As president, Lincoln learned that no matter what he did, there were going to be people who would not be pleased. Through it all, Lincoln was a man of principle, and as Thomas Jefferson said, "God grant that men of principle shall be our principal men."
Integrity is your friend's best friend. Not only is integrity your best friend, it's one of the best friends that your friends will ever have. When the people around you know that you're a person of integrity, they know that you want to influence them because of the opportunity to add value to their lives. They don't have to worry about your motives. Recently, we saw a cartoon in the New Yorker that showed how difficult it can be to sort out another person's motives. A group of hogs was assembled for a feeding, and a farmer was filling their trough to the brim. One of the pigs turned to the others and said, "Have you ever wondered why he's being so good to us?" A person of integrity influences others because he wants to bring something to the table that will benefit them, not put them on the table to benefit himself.
The benefit of integrity is trust. The bottom line when it comes to integrity is that it allows others to trust you. And without trust, you have nothing. Trust is the single most important factor in personal and professional relationships. It is the glue that holds people together. And it is a key to becoming a person of influence. The benefit of trust is influence. When you earn people's trust, then you begin to earn their confidence. And that is one of the keys to influence. As President Dwight D. Eisenhower said, "In order to be a leader, a man must have followers. And to have followers, a man must have their confidence. Hence, the supreme quality for a leader is unquestionably integrity. Without it, no real success is possible, no matter whether it is on a section gang or a football field, in the army, or in an office. If a man's associates find that he lacks forthright integrity, he will fail. His teachings and actions must square with each other. The first great need, therefore, is integrity and high purpose."
In the end, you can bend your actions to conform to your principles, or you can bend your principles to conform to your actions. It's a choice you have to make. If you want to become a person of influence, then you'd better choose the path of integrity, because all other roads ultimately lead to ruin.
It is almost impossible to overestimate the impact of integrity in the lives of people. You probably remember the Tylenol scare from years ago. Several people were found poisoned to death, and investigators traced the cause back to some contaminated Tylenol capsules. My friend Don Meyer sent me a commentary on the incident a while back. Here's what it said. Some years earlier in their mission statement, they had a line saying that they would operate with honesty and integrity. Several weeks before the Tylenol incident, the president of Johnson & Johnson sent a memo to all presidents of divisions of the company asking if they were abiding by and if they believed in the mission statement. All of the presidents came back with an affirmative answer. Reportedly, within an hour of the Tylenol crisis, the president of the company ordered all capsules off the shelf, knowing that it was a $100 million decision. When reporters asked how he could decide so easily and rapidly on such a major decision, his reply was, "I was practicing what we agreed on in our mission statement." At the bottom of the commentary, Don Meyer wrote this note, "John, it is always easy to do right when you know ahead of time what you stand for." What's true for Johnson & Johnson is true for you and for us. If you know what you stand for and act accordingly, people can trust you. You are a model of the kind of character and consistency that other people admire and want to emulate. And you've laid a good foundation, one that makes it possible for you to become a person of positive influence in their lives.
Chapter 2, A Person of Influence Nurtures Other People. Several years ago, Nancy and I decided that we wanted to help our son Eric become a little more independent. In general, he does really well. In fact, he participates in many activities that someone who's not bound by a wheelchair never gets to. But we thought he'd enjoy taking another step in his personal development, so we looked into something we'd heard about called Canine Companions for Independence, an organization that matches specially trained dogs to people with disabilities. Eric loved the idea of getting a dog, and we applied to receive one that would match his needs. For the next several weeks, we waited, and not a day went by that Eric didn't talk about it. Finally, one afternoon, we received a call from CCI telling us that they had a dog for Eric, and the next morning we took off for their center in Oceanside, California. Eric fell in love with Sable immediately. She was an energetic golden retriever who was a little over a year and a half old. The two of them went through boot camp and learned how to work together. Sable could turn lights off and on for Eric, accompany him to the store with money, and carry his purchases back for him, and a bunch of other things. As boot camp was coming to a close, one of the trainers sat down with Eric and talked with him. He said, "Eric, no matter what else you do or don't do with Sable, be sure of one thing. You have to be the one who feeds her. That's very important. It's the only way to be sure that she will bond with you and look to you as her master." For Eric, giving the dog love and affection was easy. He enjoyed petting and grooming her, but it was harder for him to learn how to take charge. He has a pretty docile personality, but in time, he learned to feed her, and it eventually became his favorite part of their routine.
Feeding a dog is the best way to create a relationship with her. It not only provides what the dog needs, giving her life and strength, but it teaches her to trust and follow you. And in most cases, when you do the feeding, the care you give is returned with loyalty, obedience, and affection. In some ways, people respond very similarly to the way some animals do. And like animals, people need to be cared for, not just physically, but emotionally. If you look around, you'll discover that there are people in your life who want to be fed with encouragement, recognition, security, and hope. That process is called nurturing, and it's a need that every human being has. If you desire to become an influencer in another person's life, the way to start is by nurturing him or her. Many people mistakenly believe that the way to become an influencer in the life of another person is to become an authority figure, correct their errors, reveal their weak areas they can't easily see in themselves, and give so-called constructive criticism. But what clergyman John Knox said over 400 years ago is still true. You cannot antagonize and influence at the same time. At the heart of the nurturing process is genuine concern for others. When you hear the word nurture, what do you first think of? If you're like most people, you probably envision a mother cradling a baby. She takes care of her child, protecting it, feeding it, encouraging it, making sure that its needs are met. She doesn't give it attention only when she's got spare time or when it's convenient. She loves it and wants it to thrive. Similarly, as we try to help and influence the people around us, we must also have positive feelings and concerns for them. If you want to help people and make a positive impact on them, you cannot dislike, despise, or disparage them. You must give love to them and give them respect. Or, as human relations expert Les Giblin says, you can't make the other fellow feel important in your presence if you secretly feel that he is a nobody. You may be wondering why you should take on a nurturing role with the people you want to influence, especially if they are employees, colleagues, or friends, not family members. You may be saying to yourself, isn't that something they can get somewhere else, like at home? The unfortunate truth is most people are desperate for encouragement, and even if they have a few people in their lives who build them up, you still need to become a nurturer to them, because people are influenced most by those who make them feel the best about themselves. If you become a major nurturer in the life of another person, then you have an opportunity to make a major impact on them. The key to becoming a nurturer is learning to be other-minded. Instead of thinking of yourself, learn to put others first. Instead of putting others in their place, try to put yourself in their place. That's not always easy. Only when you have a sense of peace about yourself and who you are will you be able to be other-minded and give yourself away to others. But the rewards of nurturing are great. When you nurture people, they receive a great deal, including these five things. Number one, positive self-worth. Nathaniel Brandon, a psychiatrist and expert on the subject of self-esteem, has stated that no factor is more decisive in people's psychological development and motivation than the value judgments they make about themselves. He says that the nature of self-evaluation has a profound effect on a person's values, beliefs, thinking processes, feelings, needs, and goals. In his view, self-esteem is the single most significant key to a person's behavior. If you want to help a person improve his quality of life, become more productive at work, and develop more positive relationships, then build his self-worth. Make him feel good about himself, and the positive benefits will spill over in every aspect of his life. And when he begins to experience those benefits, he will be grateful to you. Number two, sense of belonging. Positive influencers understand people's needs for a sense of belonging and do things that make people feel included. Parents make sure their children feel like important members of the family. Spouses make the person to whom they are married feel like a cherished equal partner. And bosses let their employees know that they are valued members of the team. Great leaders are particularly talented at making their followers feel that they belong. Napoleon Bonaparte, for example, was a master at making people feel important and included. He was known for wandering through the camp and greeting every officer by name. As he talked to each man, he would ask about his hometown, wife, and family. And the general would talk about a battle or maneuver in which he knew the man had taken part. The interest and time he took with his followers made them feel a great sense of camaraderie and belonging. It's no wonder that his men were devoted to him. Number 3, perspective. For most people, it's not what they are that holds them back. It's what they think they're not. Everyone appreciates being nurtured, even great men and women. A small exhibit at the Smithsonian Institution bears this out. It contains the personal effects found on Abraham Lincoln the night that he was shot. A small handkerchief embroidered, A. Lincoln. A country boy's penknife. A spectacle case repaired with cotton string. A Confederate $5 bill. And a worn-out newspaper clipping extolling his accomplishments as president. It begins, Abe Lincoln is one of the greatest statesmen of all time. As we mentioned in the previous chapter, Lincoln faced fierce criticism while in office, and it would have been easy for him to become totally discouraged. That article, worn with repeated reading, undoubtedly helped him during very difficult times. It nurtured him along and helped him retain his perspective. Number 4, feeling of significance. Woody Allen once said, "My only regret in life is that I'm not someone else." And while he probably said that to get a laugh, with the relationship problems he's had over the years, we can't help wondering how much truth there is in his comment. In fact, the price tag that the world puts on us is almost identical to the one we put on ourselves. People who have a great deal of self-respect and who believe that they have significance are usually respected and made to feel valued by others. When you nurture people and add value to them without expecting anything in return, they feel significant. They realize that they are valued, that they matter to others, and once they consistently feel positive about themselves, then they're free to live more positively for themselves and others. Number 5, hope. Writer Mark Twain said, "Keep away from people who try to belittle your ambitions. Small people always do that, but the really great people make you feel that you, too, can become great." How do most people feel when they're around you? Do they feel small and insignificant, or do they believe in themselves and have great hope about what they can become? Hope is perhaps the greatest gift that you can give another person as a result of nurturing, because even if a person's sense of self is weak and he fails to see his own significance, he still has a reason to keep trying and striving to reach his potential in the future.
The key to how you treat people lies in how you think about them. It's a matter of attitude. What you believe is revealed by how you act. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe said, "Treat a man as he appears to be, and you make him worse. But treat a man as if he already were what he potentially could be, and you make him what he should be." How to become a natural nurturer. Maybe you weren't born a nurturing person. Many people find it hard to be loving and positive to others, especially if the environment they grew up in wasn't particularly uplifting. But anyone can become a great nurturer and add value to others. If you cultivate a positive attitude of other-mindedness, you too can become a natural at nurturing and enjoy the added privilege of influence in the lives of others. Here's how to do it. First, commit to them. Make a commitment to becoming a nurturer. When you make a commitment to helping people, it changes your priorities and your actions. Love for others always finds a way to help. Indifference to others finds nothing but excuses. Second, believe in them. People rise or fall to meet the expectations of those closest to them. Give people your trust and hope, and they will do everything they can not to let you down. Third, be accessible to them. You can't nurture anyone from a distance. You can only do it up close. When you first start the process with people, you may need to spend a lot of time with them. But as they gain confidence in themselves and the relationship, they will require less personal contact. Until they reach that point, make sure they have good access to you. Fourth, give with no strings attached. If you need people, you cannot lead them. And nurturing is an aspect of leadership. Instead of trying to make a transaction out of it, give freely without expecting anything in return. Henry Drummond said, You will find, as you look back upon your life, that the moments when you have really lived are the moments when you have done things in a spirit of love. Fifth, give them opportunities. As the people you nurture gain strength, give them additional opportunities to succeed and grow. You will continue to nurture them, but as time goes by, their own actions and accomplishments will help to keep them secure, respected, and encouraged. And finally, sixth, lift them to a higher level. Your ultimate goal should always be to help people go to a higher level, to reach their potential. Nurturing is the foundation upon which the person can begin the building process.
One of the greatest stories of encouragement and nurturing that we've ever heard is about John Wesley, one of the influencers we mention in this book's introduction. In 1791, Wesley wrote a letter to a man named William Wilberforce, a member of England's Parliament who was in the midst of fighting for the abolition of the British slave trade. The letter, which has since become famous, said this. London, February 26, 1791. Dear Sir, unless the divine power has raised you up, I see not how you can go through your glorious enterprise in opposing that execrable villainy, which is the scandal of religion, of England, and of human nature. Unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you will be worn out by the opposition of men and devils. But if God be for you, who can be against you? Are all of them stronger than God? Oh, be not weary in well-doing. Go on, in the name of God and in the power of His might, till even American slavery, the vilest that ever saw the sun, shall vanish away before it. That He who has guided you from your youth up may continue to strengthen you in this and all things, is the prayer of your affectionate servant, John Wesley. 4 days later, Wesley was dead at the age of 88, yet his influence in Wilberforce's life continued for years. Wilberforce did not succeed in convincing Parliament to abolish slavery at that time, but he didn't give up the fight. He kept at it for decades despite slander, vilification, and threats. And when he thought he couldn't go on any farther, he looked to Wesley's letter for encouragement. Finally, in 1807, the slave trade was abolished. And in 1833, several months after Wilberforce's death, slavery was outlawed in all of the British Empire. Though condemned by many during his career, Wilberforce was buried with honor in Westminster Abbey, one of the most esteemed men of his day. Part of his epitaph reads, "Eminent as he was in every department of public labor, and a leader in every work of charity, whether to relieve the temporal or the spiritual wants of his fellow men, his name will be specially identified with those exertions, which by the blessing of God removed from England the guilt of the African slave trade, and prepared the way for the abolition of slavery in every colony of the empire." Maybe there is a William Wilberforce in your life, just waiting to be nurtured to greatness. The only way you'll ever know is to become a nurturer who is other-minded and adds value to the people he meets. Chapter 3. A person of influence has faith in people. Jim grew up in Niagara Falls, New York. Today the population is about 60,000, but back when Jim lived there, it was closer to 100,000 people. It was a thriving industrial center with companies such as DuPont Chemical. It also had cultural offerings, a strong 100-year-old university, and other attractions. But the main focus of the town back then was the incredible natural wonder of the falls, as it still is today. The Iroquois Indians called it Niagara, meaning thunder of waters. It's an awesome sight. Every minute, more than 12 million cubic feet of water drops a distance of about 180 feet over the edge of the falls, and its total width, including both Canadian and American portions, measures over 3,100 feet. It is rightly called one of the natural wonders of the world.
Back when we were growing up, we heard a lot of stories about the falls and the daredevil stunts people used to pull, like Annie Edson Taylor's going over the falls in a barrel and things like that. One of the great legends of the town was a French acrobat named Charles Blondin, who lived from 1824 to 1897. He crossed over the entire width of the falls on a tightrope back in 1859. That must have taken nerves of steel, since a fall certainly would have killed him. In fact, he crossed the falls several times. He did it once with a wheelbarrow, another time blindfolded, and yet another time on stilts. They say he was quite remarkable. He continued performing even into his 70s. One of the most incredible feats he performed was crossing the falls on a tightrope while carrying a man on his back. Can you imagine that? I guess just crossing over by himself wasn't tough enough for him. But as difficult as that feat might have been on Blondin, I can't help wondering how he got someone to go with him. That's what you call trust, to climb onto the back of a man who's going to walk more than half a mile on a rope suspended over one of the most powerful waterfalls in the world. I used to think about that as a kid. What would it be like to see the falls from up on a rope above them? And more importantly, what person would trust me to carry him across the falls the way that man trusted Blondin?
We can't tell you the identity of the man Blondin carried across the falls, but there's no question that he had great faith in the French acrobat. After all, he put his life in the man's hands. You don't see that kind of trust in others every day. But the times you do, it's a very special thing. Faith in people is one of the most important qualities an influencer can have when working with others. Yet it's quite a scarce commodity today. Listen to the following four facts about faith. Number one, most people don't have faith in themselves. Number two, most people don't have someone who has faith in them. Number three, most people can tell when someone has faith in them. And number four, most people will do anything to live up to your faith in them. People rise or fall to meet our level of expectations for them. If you express skepticism and doubt in others, they'll return your lack of confidence with mediocrity. But if you believe in them and expect them to do well, they will go the extra mile trying to do their best. And in the process, both of you will benefit. John H. Spalding expressed the thought this way when he said, "Those who believe in our ability do more than stimulate us. They create for us an atmosphere in which it becomes easier to succeed." If you've never been one to trust people and put faith in them, change your way of thinking and begin believing in others. Your life will quickly begin to improve. When you have faith in another person, you give him or her an incredible gift, maybe the best gift you can give another person.
Faith is belief in action. Having faith in people requires more than just words or even just positive feelings about people. It has to be backed up with what we do. As Point Loma College Professor Emeritus W.T. Perkheiser said, "Faith is more than thinking something is true. Faith is thinking something is true to the extent that we act on it." If you want to help other people and make a positive impact on their lives, you have to treat them with that kind of confidence. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "Trust men and they will be true to you. Treat them greatly and they will show themselves great." Become a believer in others, and even the most tentative and inexperienced people can bloom right before your eyes.
How to become a believer in people. We're fortunate because we grew up in positive, affirming environments. As a result, we have an easy time believing in people and expressing that belief. When you have faith in yourself, it is easy to have faith in others. But we realize that not everyone has the benefit of that kind of positive upbringing. Most people need to learn how to have faith in others. To help build your belief in others, try using these six suggestions created using the initial letters of the word believe.
B is for believe in them before they succeed. Everyone loves a winner. It's easy to have faith in people who've already proven themselves. It's much tougher to believe in people before they've proven themselves. But that's the key to motivating people to reach their potential. You have to believe in them first, before they become successful, and sometimes before they even believe in themselves. There are people in your life who desperately want to believe in themselves, but who have very little hope. As you interact with them, remember the motto of French World War I hero Marshal Ferdinand Foch. There are no hopeless situations. There are only men and women who have grown hopeless about them. Every person has seeds of greatness within, even though they may currently be laying dormant. But when you believe in people, you water those seeds and give them the chance to grow. Every time you put your faith in them, you're giving life-sustaining water, warmth, food, and light. And if you continue to give encouragement through your belief in them, these people will bloom in time.
E is for emphasize their strengths. We mentioned previously that many people mistakenly think that to be influential in other people's lives, they have to be an authority and point out their deficiencies. The best way to show people your faith in them and motivate them is to focus your attention on their strengths. According to author and advertising executive Bruce Barton, nothing splendid has ever been achieved except by those who dared believe that something inside them was superior to circumstances. When you emphasize people's strengths, you're helping them believe that they possess what they need to succeed.
L is for list their past successes. Even when you spend your time emphasizing people's strengths, they may still need further encouragement to show them you believe in them and to get them motivated. Entrepreneur Mary Kay Ash says, "Everyone has an invisible sign hanging from his neck saying, 'Make me feel important.'" Never forget this message when working with people. One of the best ways to do that is to help people to remember their past successes. If you can show others that they've done well in the past and help them see their past victories have paved the way for future success, they'll be better able to move into action. Listing past successes helps others believe in themselves.
I is for instill confidence when they fail. When you've encouraged people and put your faith in them, and they begin to believe they can succeed in life, they soon reach a critical crossroads. The first time or two that they fail, and they will fail because it's a part of life, they have two choices. They can give in or go on. To give them a push and inspire them, you need to keep showing your confidence in them, even when they're making mistakes or doing poorly. In time, they will learn to think the way baseball legend Babe Ruth did when he said, "Never let the fear of striking out get in the way."
E is for experience some wins together. It's not enough just knowing that failure is part of moving forward in life. To really become motivated to succeed, people need to believe they can win. John, like many of us, got a taste for winning when he was just a kid.
That's right, Jim. Growing up, I idolized my brother Larry, who is 2.5 years older than I am. After my parents, he was probably the greatest influencer in my life when I was a kid. Larry has always been a leader and an excellent athlete. And whenever we played basketball, football, or baseball with the kids in the neighborhood, Larry was the captain. A lot of times when they picked up teams, I would be one of the last picked because I was younger and smaller than most of the kids. But as I got older, Larry began picking me more and more, and that began to make me feel good, not only because it meant my brother cared about me, but because I knew that when Larry picked me, I was going to be on the winning team. You see, Larry was a fierce competitor, and he didn't like losing. He always played to win, and he usually did. Together, we put quite a few wins under our belts, and I came to expect victory when I played with my brother.
Winning is motivating. Novelist David Ambrose said, "If you have the will to win, you have achieved half your success. If you don't, you have achieved half your failure." When you can come alongside others to help them experience some wins with you, it gives them reasons to believe they will succeed. And in the process, they begin to sense victory. That's when incredible things begin to happen in their lives.
V is for visualize their future success. It's been said that a person can live 40 days without food, 4 days without water, 4 minutes without air, but only 4 seconds without hope. Each time you cast vision for others and paint a picture of their future success, you build them up, motivate them, and give them reasons to keep on going.
E is for expect a new level of living. German statesman Konrad Adenauer observed, "We all live under the same sky, but we don't all have the same horizon." As an influencer, your goal is to help others see beyond today and their current circumstances and dream big dreams. When you put your faith in people, you help them expand their horizons and motivate them to move to a whole new level of living.
The key to that new way of living is a change in attitude. Dennis Waitley said, "The winner's edge is not in a gifted birth, a high IQ, or in talent. The winner's edge is all in the attitude, not aptitude. Attitude is the criterion for success. as people's attitudes change from doubt to confidence in themselves and their ability to succeed and reach their potential, everything in their lives changes for the better. Jim, I know you and Nancy gained incredible insights about the power of putting faith into others several years ago when you decided to take a chance with your son Eric on a mountain in Utah.
That's true. About 5 years ago, Nancy and I got the idea that we should take Eric skiing. She had heard from a friend about a place in Park City, Utah, called the National Ability Center. There they offer people with disabilities instruction and assistance in snow skiing, swimming, tennis, water skiing, horseback riding, rafting, and other activities. She thought the experience would be great for his self-esteem. I have to admit, I was skeptical about it from the very beginning. I had trouble imagining Eric racing down a 10,000-foot mountain, knowing how difficult the sport is for me. And that wasn't helped by the knowledge that a blow to his head could cause him to have a seizure or put him in the hospital for more brain surgery. But Nancy had faith that Eric could do it. And when she believes, so does he. And off we went to give it a try. When we got up to Deer Valley and met some of the people who work at the National Ability Center, I started to feel a little bit better about it. They were professional and extremely positive. They showed us the equipment that Eric would be using, a type of bi-ski with a molded seat. Eric would be put in the chair and steer using a bar attached to little outrigger skis. When we started to fill out the paperwork, we were momentarily paralyzed when we read the waiver that said Eric would be, quote, engaging in activities that involve risk of serious injury, including permanent disability and death, unquote. It made the risk seem very real, but by this time, Eric was very excited, and we didn't want him to see any hesitation from us. After Velcro fastening Eric into his bi-ski and giving him some pointers, Stephanie, his young instructor, took him up the bunny slope. About 10 minutes later, we got excited as we saw Eric coming down the hill with the biggest smile on his face. We were so proud of him that we were giving him high fives and patting him on the back. I thought to myself, well, that wasn't so bad. Then off they went again. What we didn't know was that this time they were going to the top of the mountain. At the bottom of the hill, we waited and waited. We weren't sure whether we'd see Eric come down the mountain on his skis or on a stretcher with the ski patrol. Finally, after about 30 minutes, we saw him and Stephanie come around a bend and ski to the bottom of the slope. His cheeks were flushed, and he was grinning like a Cheshire cat. He loved it. "Move over, Dad," he said as he blew past us. "I'm going up again." Eric skied every day on that trip. In fact, when he was done skiing one day, he told us, "Stephanie didn't take me up the mountain today." "Oh," said Nancy, "then who skied with you?" "Some one-legged guy," answered Eric. "What?" Nancy said, "What do you mean, some one-legged guy?" "Yep," said Eric, "a one-legged guy." And then Eric smiled mischievously and said, "Want to know how he lost his leg? Avalanche."
Eric's been skiing every year since then, and his life hasn't been the same since. He's now got a confidence he never had before, and he's willing to try just about anything. He swims 3 days a week. He works out with weights, plays power soccer. I guess you could say that he has adopted the motto of the National Ability Center as his own. If I can do this, I can do anything. If they had done things Jim's way, Eric might not have gotten the chance to experience what he did on the mountain in Utah 5 years ago. Jim loves Eric with all of his heart, but he tends to want to play it safe. Putting your faith in others does involve taking a chance. But the rewards so outweigh the risk that there is no comparison. Robert Louis Stevenson said, "To be what we are and to become what we are capable of becoming is the only end in life." When you put your faith in others, you help them reach their potential, and you become an important influencer in their lives. Chapter number 4. A person of influence listens to people. If you're going on a job interview today, what would you say is the most important skill that you would need? Is it writing to create a knockout resume? Or maybe salesmanship? After all, isn't that what you're there to do on an interview? Sell yourself? Or how about charisma? If you're charismatic, you're sure to get the job you want, right? Or let's say that instead of going out on an interview, you are going to spend your day recruiting, whether for business prospects, ministry workers, or people to play on your softball team. What kind of skill would you need as a recruiter? Discernment? An eye for talent? the ability to cast vision and get people excited. Or maybe it would be hard-nosed negotiation skills. Better yet, let's say your job today was to supply new ideas for your organization. What qualities would you need? Creativity? Intelligence? Would you need a good education? What is the number one ability you would need? No matter which one of these three tasks you were to take on today, there is one skill that you would need over all the others, more than talent, discernment, or charm. It is the one skill that all great leaders recognize as indispensable to their ability to influence others and succeed. Have you guessed what it is? It's the ability to listen. When President Lyndon B. Johnson was a junior senator from Texas, he kept a sign on his office wall that read, "You ain't learning nothing when you're doing all the talking." And Woodrow Wilson, the 28th American president, once said, "The ear of the leader must ring with the voices of the people." The ability to skillfully listen is one of the keys to gaining influence with others. It shows respect, builds relationships, increases knowledge, generates ideas, and builds loyalty. It also is a great way to help others while helping yourself. When you become a good listener, you have the ability to develop strong relationships, gather valuable information, and increase your understanding of yourself and others. As our friend Zig Ziglar says, you can get everything in life you want if you help enough other people get what they want. When you listen to others, you put yourself in a place where you can give that help. Listening is one of the most valuable skills that you will ever develop. According to Brian Adams, author of Sales Cybernetics, during the average waking day, we spend the best part of it listening. He offers the following statistics. 9% of the day is spent writing. 16% of the day is spent reading. 30% of the day is spent speaking. 45% of the day is spent listening. In order to become a good listener, you have to want to hear. But you also need some skills to help you with that process. Here are 9 suggestions to help you become a better listener.
Number 1, look at the speaker. The whole listening process begins with giving the other person your undivided attention. As you interact with others, don't catch up on other work, shuffle papers, do the dishes, or watch television. Set aside the time to focus only on the other person. And if you don't have the time right at that moment, then schedule it as soon as you can.
Number 2, don't interrupt. Most people react badly to being interrupted. It makes them feel disrespected. And according to Robert L. Montgomery, author of Listening Made Easy, it's just as rude to step on people's ideas as it is to step on their toes. If you are in the habit of interrupting other people, examine your motives and determine to make a change. Give people the time they need to express themselves. And don't feel that one of you has to be speaking all the time. Periods of silence can be good. They give you a chance to reflect on what's been said so that you can respond appropriately.
Number 3, focus on understanding. Have you ever noticed how quickly most people forget the things they hear? We're told that studies at institutions such as Michigan State, Ohio State, Florida State, and the University of Minnesota indicate that most people can recall only 50% of what they hear immediately after hearing it. And as time passes, their ability to remember continues to drop. By the next day, their retention is usually down to about 25%. One of the ways to combat that tendency is to make your goal understanding rather than just remembering facts. Herb Cohen says, "Effective listening requires more than hearing the words transmitted. It demands that you find meaning and understanding in what is being said. After all, meanings are not in the words, but in people." Put yourself in the other person's place and your ability to understand will increase. And the greater your ability to understand, the better listener you'll become.
Number 4, determine the need at the moment. One of the greatest keys to becoming an effective listener is the ability to discern the other person's need at the moment. People talk for so many different reasons. To receive comfort, to vent, to persuade, to inform, to be understood, or to relieve nervousness. Often people talk to you for reasons that don't match your expectations. For example, a lot of men and women find themselves in conflict because they occasionally communicate at crossed purposes. They neglect to determine the need of the other person at the moment of interaction. Men usually want to fix any problem that they discuss. Their need is resolution. Women, on the other hand, are more likely to tell about a problem they have simply to share it. Solutions are often neither requested nor desired. Anytime you can determine the current need of the people you're communicating with, you can put whatever they say into the appropriate context, and you will be better able to understand them.
Number 5, check your emotions. Just about everyone carries around some emotional baggage that causes them to react to certain people or situations. Any time that you find yourself becoming highly emotional when listening to another person, then check your emotions, especially if your reaction seems to be stronger than the situation warrants. You don't want to make some unsuspecting person the recipient of your venting. Besides, even if your reactions are not due to some event from your past, you should always allow others to finish explaining their points of view, ideas, or convictions before offering your own.
Number 6, suspend your judgment. Have you ever begun listening to another person tell a story and started to respond to it before he or she was finished? Just about everyone has. But the truth is, you can't jump to conclusions and be a good listener at the same time. As you talk to others, wait to hear the whole story before you respond. If you don't, you may miss the most important thing they intend to say.
Number 7, sum up at major intervals. John H. Melchinger suggests, comment on what you hear and individualize your comments. For example, you can say, Cheryl, that's obviously very important to you. It will help keep you on track as a listener. Get beyond, that's interesting. If you train yourself to comment meaningfully, the speaker will know that you're listening and may offer further information. One of the best techniques for active listening is to sum up what the other person says at major intervals. As the speaker finishes one subject, paraphrase his or her main points or ideas before going on to the next one and verify that you've gotten the right message. It reassures that person and helps you to stay focused on what he or she is trying to communicate.
Number 8, ask questions for clarity. Have you ever noticed that top reporters are excellent listeners? Take someone like Barbara Walters, for example. She practices great listening skills. She looks at the speaker, focuses on understanding, suspends judgment, and sums up what the person has to say. People trust her and seem to be willing to tell her just about anything. But she also practices another skill that helps her to gather more information and increase her understanding of the person she's interviewing. She asks good questions. If you want to become an effective listener, become a good reporter, not a stick-the-microphone-in-your-face-and-bark questions-at-your kind of reporter, but someone who gently asks follow-up questions and seeks clarification. If you show people how much you care and ask in a non-threatening way, you'll be amazed by how much they'll tell you.
Finally, number 9, always make listening your priority. The last thing to remember when developing your listening skills is to make listening a priority. No matter how busy you become or how far you rise in your organization, a great example of a busy executive who made time for listening is the late Sam Walton, founder of Walmart and one of the richest men in America. He believed in listening to what people had to say, especially his employees. He once flew his plane to Mount Pleasant, Texas, landed, and gave instructions to his co-pilot to meet him about 100 miles down the road. He then rode in a Walmart truck the rest of the way just so that he could chat with the driver. We should all give listening that kind of priority.
The ability to listen is something many people take for granted today. Most people consider listening to be easy, and they see themselves as pretty good listeners. But while it's true that most people are able to hear, fewer are capable of really listening. In our careers, we have done a lot of speaking. Between the two of us, we speak to several hundred thousand people every year. And Jim's wife, Nancy, does a lot of speaking, too. Believe me, she's a great talker. But she's also a wonderful listener. And sometimes when she speaks, she talks about communication and the importance of listening. Not long ago, she did a talk about listening, which emphasized giving other people the benefit of doubt and trying to see things from their point of view. In the audience that day was a man named Rodney. Though he was happily married and had a young son, he had been previously married and had two daughters with his first wife, and he was having a lot of problems with her. She was constantly calling him and asking for more money for herself and the two girls. They argued continually, and she was driving him nuts, so much that he had already hired an attorney and was preparing to sue her. But when Rodney heard Nancy speak about listening that day, he realized how insensitive he had been to his ex-wife, Charlotte. A couple of days later, he called her and asked if they could meet. She was, of course, suspicious of Rodney, and even asked her attorney to call him to find out what he was up to. But eventually, Rodney convinced them that he just wanted to talk, and finally Charlotte agreed to see him. They met at a coffee shop, and Rodney said, "Charlotte, I want to listen to you. Tell me what your life is like. I do care about you and the kids." "I didn't think you cared about the girls at all," she said, and she began to cry. "I do," he said. "I'm sorry. I've only been thinking of myself, and I haven't been thinking of you. Please forgive me." "Why are you doing this?" she asked. "Because I want to make things right," he answered. "I've been angry for so long that I couldn't see straight. Now tell me how things are going for you and the girls." For a while, all Charlotte could do was sob. But then she started telling him about her struggles as a single parent, and how she was doing her best to bring up the girls, but that it didn't seem like enough. They talked for hours, and as they did, the beginning of a new foundation of mutual respect began to form. In time, they believe that they will be able to become friends again. Rodney is probably not alone. You may also have people in your life that you would like to make some changes with. Who haven't you been listening to lately? And what are you going to do about it? It's never too late to become a good listener. It can change your life and the lives of the people in your life. Chapter number 5. A person of influence understands people. The other night over dinner, the two of us got to talking and we started to explore some questions. How does a person build an organization? What does it take? What is the key to becoming successful? For example, what did it take for a person like Jim to build a business organization that's active in 26 countries and impacts the lives of hundreds of thousands of people?
And for John, what did it take to triple the size of his church, making it the largest in its denomination, and in the process increase its budget from around $800,000 to over $5 million and raise active involvement by volunteers from just 112 to over 1,800 people?
We've found that it doesn't matter whether your business is creating computer software, building a church, running a business, serving food in a restaurant, building houses, or designing airplanes. The key to success is understanding people.
That's right. John and I are very different. I didn't grow up with an orientation toward people as he did. He took Dale Carnegie courses while he was still in high school and went off to college knowing he would be in a people job. But I went to Purdue University and studied aeronautical engineering. By the time I finished with my bachelor's degree, I thought there were two keys to success in any job: hard work and technical skills. It never even occurred to me that people skills had any value. I entered my first job ready to work and loaded with technical knowledge. Purdue had given me a first-rate education, and I had always believed in working hard. But it didn't take me long to realize that success in business means being able to work with people. In fact, all of life is dealing with people. I found that to be true not only professionally as an engineer, a consultant, and an entrepreneur, but in every aspect of living. Whether I was interacting with my family, working with one of my kids' teachers, or socializing with friends. If you can't understand people and work with them, you can't accomplish anything, and you certainly can't become a person of influence.
The ability to understand people is one of the greatest assets anyone can ever have. It has the potential to positively impact every area of your life, not just in the business arena. David Burns, a medical doctor and a professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania, says, "The biggest mistake you can make in trying to talk convincingly is to put your highest priority on expressing your ideas and feelings. What most people really want is to be listened to, respected, and understood. The moment people see that they are being understood, they become more motivated to understand your point of view. If you can learn to understand people, how they think, what they feel, what inspires them, how they're likely to act and react in a given situation, then you can motivate and influence them in a positive way."
Lack of understanding for others is a huge source of tension in society today. But if understanding is such a great asset, why don't more people practice it? There are many reasons. Fear, self-centeredness, failure to appreciate one another's differences, and failure to acknowledge the things we have in common, to name just a few. Knowing what people need and want is really the key to understanding them. And if you can understand them, you can influence them and impact their lives in a positive way. If we were to boil down all the things we know about understanding people and narrow them down to a short list, we'd identify these five things. Number one, everybody wants to be somebody. There isn't a person in the world who doesn't have the desire to be someone, to have significance. Even the least ambitious and unassuming person wants to be regarded highly by others. John, do you remember the first time feelings were stirred up inside of you to be someone important?
I sure do, Jim. It was when I went to my first basketball game when I was 9 years old. I can still see it in my head. I stood with my buddies in the balcony of the gym. The thing that I remember most wasn't the game. It was the announcement of the starting lineups. They turned out all the lights, and then some spotlights came on. Then the announcer called out the names of the starters, and they ran out into the middle of the floor one by one with everybody in the place cheering. I hung over the balcony that day and said, "Wow, I'd like that to happen to me." In fact, by the time the introductions were over, I looked over to my friend Bobby Wilson and I said, "Bobby, when I get to high school, they're going to announce my name, and I'm going to run out in the spotlight to the middle of the basketball floor, and the people are going to cheer for me because I'm going to become somebody." I went home that night and I told my dad, "I want to be a basketball player." Soon afterward, he got me a Spalding basketball and we put a goal on the garage. For the next several years, I used to shovel snow off that driveway to practice my foul shots and play basketball because I had a dream of becoming somebody. It's funny how that kind of dream can impact your life. I remember in the sixth grade, we played intramural basketball, and our team won a couple of games, so we got to go to the old Mill Street Gym in Circleville, Ohio, where I had seen that basketball game in the fourth grade. When we got there, instead of going out onto the floor with the rest of the players as they were warming up, I went over to the bench where those high school players had been 2 years before. I sat right where they had, and I closed my eyes. That's the equivalent of turning the lights out in the gym. Then in my head, I heard my name announced, and I ran out into the middle of the floor. It felt so good to hear that imaginary applause that I thought, "I'll do it again." So I did. In fact, I did it three times, and all of a sudden I realized that my buddies weren't playing basketball. They were just watching me in disbelief. But I didn't care, because I was one step closer to being the person I dreamed about becoming.
Everybody has that desire to feel important, to be regarded and valued by others. Everybody wants to be somebody. Once that piece of information becomes a part of your everyday thinking, you'll gain incredible insight into why people do the things they do. And if you treat every person you meet as if he were the most important person in the world, you'll communicate that he is somebody to you. The second thing we know about people is that nobody cares how much you know until he knows how much you care.
That is so true. One of the most important things you need to know as an influencer is that you've got to love people before you try to lead them. The moment that people know that you care for and about them, the way they feel about you changes. Showing others that you care isn't easy. Your greatest times and fondest memories will come because of people, but so will your most difficult, painful, and tragic times. People are your greatest asset and your greatest liability. The challenge is to keep caring about them no matter what. If you want to help others and become a person of influence, then you've got to keep smiling, sharing, giving, and turning the other cheek. That's the right way to treat people. Besides, you never know which people in your sphere of influence are going to rise up and make a difference in your life and the lives of others.
Number three, everybody needs somebody. Contrary to popular belief, there are no such things as self-made men and women. Everybody needs friendship, encouragement, and help. What people can accomplish by themselves is almost nothing compared to the potential they have when working with others. And doing things with other people tends to bring contentment. Besides, Lone Rangers are rarely happy people. As King Solomon of ancient Israel said, Two are better than one because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can pick him up. But pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. Everybody needs somebody to come alongside them and help them. If you understand that, are willing to give to others and help them, and maintain the right motives, it can change their lives and yours. Number four, everybody can be somebody when somebody understands and believes in him. It doesn't take much effort to help other people feel important. Little things done deliberately at the right time can make a big difference.
That's true, Jim. As you know, for 14 years, I was privileged to pastor a very large congregation at Skyline Church in the San Diego area, where we did a Christmas program every year. We used to do 28 performances, and altogether about 30,000 people saw it each year. The show always included a bunch of children, and one of my favorite parts of the show several years ago was a song in which about 300 kids dressed like angels sang while holding candles. Toward the end of the song, they walked off the stage, came up the aisle, and exited out the lobby in front of the church. During the first performance, I decided to wait for them back in the lobby. They didn't know I was going to be there, but as they went by, I clapped, praised them, and said, "Kids, you did a great job." They were surprised to see me, and they looked up and said, "Hi, Pastor. Hi. Hey, look, Pastor's here." For the second performance, I did the same thing again, and I could see, as they started to walk up the aisles, that they were looking back expectantly to see if I was standing there to cheer them on. By the third performance of the night, as they turned the corner to come up the aisle, they had smiles on their faces. And when they got to the lobby, they were giving me high fives and we were having a great time. Why? Because they knew I believed in them, and it made all of them feel like they were somebody.
When was the last time you went out of your way to make people feel special? Like they were somebody. It doesn't really take much. The investment required on your part is totally overshadowed by the impact it makes on them. Everyone you know and all the people you meet have the potential to be someone important in the lives of others. All they need is encouragement and motivation from you to help them reach their potential. Finally, number five, anybody who helps somebody influences a lot of bodies. The final thing you need to understand about people is that when you help one person, you're really impacting a lot of other people. That's because what you give to one person overflows into the lives of all the people that that person impacts. The nature of influence is to multiply. It impacts the person you touch and the people that he or she in turn touches. It even impacts you, because when you help others and your motives are good, you always get back more than you can ever give. Most people are so genuinely grateful when another person makes them feel like they're somebody special that they never tire of showing their gratitude.
In the end, the ability to understand people is a choice. It's true that some people are born with great instincts that enable them to understand how others think and feel. But even if you aren't an instinctive people person, you can improve your ability to work with others. The ability to understand, motivate, and ultimately influence others is a skill that every person is capable of having. Jim was recently reminded of the importance of understanding people and seeing things from their perspective when visiting his aging parents in New York recently.
My parents are in their late 80s, and they worked hard all their lives. Growing up, we always lived in a very small house, and after my parents retired, they sold it and moved to a small apartment to live on their modest pensions. Like most people who have been blessed financially, Nancy and I are always looking for ways to help our parents and repay them in some small way for the positive things they have done for us over the years. Recently, we thought we could help them by leasing them a penthouse unit in the most prestigious apartment building in the city. It was incredible and even had a view of Niagara Falls. But after about 6 months, my parents asked if they could move out. My mother's eyesight was so poor that she couldn't see the falls. Dad, on the other hand, could see the falls fine, but was made extremely uncomfortable by being up so high. We were disappointed that they didn't like it,
but we readily agreed to move them back into their small apartment. My desire to help them was still strong, so one day after we got them squared away in their place, I took Mom to the store. Though she claimed she didn't need anything, I did manage to talk her into letting me get her a few items, a new trash can, some flatware, a small radio, and a new toaster. Nancy and I had wanted to get them big things, but that's not what was important to them. They were happy with the toaster. Oh yes, there was one other item they finally admitted that they could use, a small tree for the front of their apartment. They thought it would be nice to have some shade in the summer when they sat outside. "But they're so expensive," my mom said. "Just get us a little sapling. We wanted them to have shade today, not 15 years from now, so we went out and got them the biggest tree we could find. It didn't take a lot of money to make them happy, just a little understanding."
Not everyone learns that lesson. Lots of people spend their lives trying to push their own agenda, and then they wonder why they have no pull with others. The key to making an impact on others is to find out what people want and then help them get it. That's what motivates them, and that's what makes it possible for you to become a person of influence in their lives.
Chapter 6, A Person of Influence Enlarges People. Over the years, my wife Nancy and I have learned a lot from our son Eric. He's been through more than 30 individual brain operations, but that's never stopped him from being mentally sharp and full of optimism. And his great sense of humor keeps us all entertained. During one of his many surgeries, Eric experienced an intraoperative stroke. The resulting loss of muscle balance has limited the use of his right hand and given him severe curvature of the spine. After a couple of years, that required another surgery in which the doctors performed spinal fusion and implanted steel rods from the base of his neck all the way down to his pelvis. He spent 3 months in a full body cast during his recovery, and as a result, many of his previous abilities were reduced dramatically. But Eric came through it all with characteristically positive spirits. After Eric's spinal surgery, Nancy could no longer handle him alone, so we decided it was time to employ a full-time home attendant to lift him and help with his daily life and assist him with his ongoing rehabilitation. We knew the type of person we wanted to hire, but we had no idea where or how to locate him. One day, while Nancy was talking to one of our medical contacts, she heard about a person named Fernando. He sounded great. "He's the perfect person," our friend said, "but you'll never get him." Nancy's response was, "Just give us his number and let us worry about whether or not we can get him." A few weeks later, we hired Fernando, and he's been wonderful. Fernando had been a life skills trainer for Sharp Hospital, and though he was only 5 years older than Eric, he had already been a manager of a group home for abused kids and had worked in a field of rehabilitation for 7 years. He and Eric bonded immediately. Fernando provided the perfect combination of professional skills and companionship. It's difficult to describe what a wonderful gift God has provided to Eric and our family in the person of Fernando. He sees his mission as that of enlarging Eric, to keep him growing toward his full potential. Fernando constantly learns new information and techniques in his field, and he seeks ways to expose Eric to new experiences and to challenge him to grow. As a result, Eric's life hasn't been the same. In the time that the two of them have been doing things together, Eric has done a lot more than go skiing every year. He's learned to jet ski. I never could have visualized Eric going 40 miles an hour over the water, but Fernando believed Eric could do it, and so he did it. Eric also volunteers as a tutor with second graders, studies German, works in our office 2 days a week, swims a couple of days a week, and has begun to work out with weights. It's hard for us to remember that Eric is severely limited physically because his life is full, challenging, and expanding every day. One of Eric's greatest experiences since teaming with Fernando has been his involvement in power soccer. It's a new sport played by people in power wheelchairs. They meet in gymnasiums where they compete as teams and score goals using a large ball. Eric loves it and usually prefers to play goalie. Not long ago, Fernando took Eric to Vancouver, Canada, to compete in a power soccer tournament. It was quite an experience for Eric. They flew together, rented a car, got their hotel room, and got around town, just the two of them. Eric loved it, especially competing in the 5-day tournament, where he scored 2 goals. And best of all, his team won the gold medal. We had never seen Eric so excited as he was when he returned from the tournament. He wore his gold medal home on the plane, and I don't think he touched the ground for days. Since then, his confidence has been so strong that he's willing to tackle just about any kind of challenge. And for that, Fernando deserves most of the credit. Without his belief in Eric and his desire to expand his world, none of this would have ever happened.
To become a person of influence and to make a positive impact on people, you have to come alongside them and really get involved in their lives. That's what Fernando did and continues to do with Jim's son, Eric. And that's what you need to do with people of whom you want to make a difference. Modeling a life of integrity is an important first step in becoming an influencer because it creates a strong foundation with others. And the next natural step is motivating people. As you nurture people, show your faith in them, listen to their hopes and fears, and demonstrate your understanding of them, you build a strong relational connection and give them an incentive to succeed and to be influenced by you. But if you want people to be able to really grow, improve, and succeed, you have to take the next step with them. You have to mentor and enlarge them.
Enlarging others is an investment. Author Alan Loy McGinnis said, "There is no more noble occupation in the world than to assist another human being, to help someone succeed." Helping others enlarge themselves is one of the most incredible things you can ever do for another person. As John says in his book, The Success Journey, growing to reach your potential is one of the three components to being successful, along with knowing your purpose and sowing seeds that benefit others. When you enlarge others, you do a number of things. You raise their level of living, you increase their potential for success, and you increase their capacity for growth. And in the process, you also increase the potential of your organization.
Make yourself an enlarger. For many people, just because they want to enlarge others doesn't necessarily mean they are ready for the task. They usually need to do some work on themselves first. As in most instances in life, if you want to do more for others, you have to become more yourself. That's never more valid than in the area of mentoring. You can teach what you know, but you can reproduce only what you are. Just as no one will follow a person whose leadership skills are weaker than their own, no person will learn to grow from someone who isn't growing himself. Not only must you be on a higher level in your personal growth, you must be continuing to grow on an ongoing basis. You can probably remember how little you respected one of your high school teachers or college professors who had obviously stopped learning and growing decades earlier, possibly the day he received his degree. Albert Schweitzer said, "The great secret of success is to go through life as a man who never gets used up." When you make it a goal to continually learn and enlarge yourself, you become the kind of person who can never be used up. You're always recharging your batteries and finding better ways to get things done. To determine whether you are still growing, ask yourself what you're still looking forward to. If you can't think of anything or you're looking back instead of ahead, your growth may be at a standstill. Make it a priority to take them through the enlarging process. Enlarging others can be rewarding and fun, but it also takes time, money, and a lot of work. That's why you've got to commit yourself to the process and make it one of your top priorities. My friend Ed Cole says, "There is a price to pay to grow. Commitment is the price." Once you've made the commitment, you're ready to go. To maximize the enlarging process, follow these 9 guidelines.
Number 1, see their potential. Unrealized potential is a great waste. And as an enlarger, one of your greatest privileges is to help others discover and then develop their potential. But that can't be done until you see their potential yourself. Olympic gold medal swimmer Jeffrey Gabarino says, "The real contest is always between what you've done and what you're capable of doing." Whenever you look at a person that you desire to enlarge, try to discern what he's capable of doing. Look for that spark of greatness. Try to visualize what that person would be doing if he were to overcome personal obstacles, gain confidence, grow in areas of promise, and give everything he had. That will help you to see his potential.
Number 2, cast a vision for their future. Robert Orban said, Always remember there are only two kinds of people in this world, the realist and the dreamers. The realists know where they are going. The dreamers have already been there. One of the greatest ways to add value to the people you enlarge is to travel ahead of them in your mind's eye and see their future before they do. When you do that, you become able to cast a vision for their future that helps to motivate and enlarge them.
Number three, tap into their passion. As an enlarger of people, one of your goals is to help people want to grow, and one of the greatest ways to do that is to tap into their passion. Everybody has passion for something, even the quietest, least demonstrative person. The key is to find it. As scientist Willis R. Whitney said, "Some men have thousands of reasons why they cannot do what they want to do, when all they need is one reason why they can." As you look for other people's passions, go beyond the surface of their daily wants. Look deep within them. Harold Kushner said, "Our souls are not hungry for fame, comfort, wealth, or power. Those rewards create almost as many problems as they solve. Our souls are hungry for meaning, for the sense that we have figured out how to live so that our lives matter, so that the world will at least be a little bit different for our having passed through it." Once you discover their passion, tap into it. Show them how it can activate their potential to the point that they will be able to realize the vision they have for their lives. Passion can help them make their dreams come true.
Number four, address any character flaws. As you begin to look at how you can help others enlarge themselves, you need to address any character issues that people might have. As we mentioned in Chapter 1, integrity is the foundation upon which everything else must stand in a person's life. No matter how much enlarging you do, if the foundation isn't solid, there's going to be trouble. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy. Your goal should be to help the people you're developing be able to stand strong in the midst of challenges."
Number five, focus on their strengths first. When developing people, focus on sharpening skills that already exist. Complement positive qualities. Bring out the gifts inherent in them. Weaknesses can wait unless they are character flaws. Only after you have developed a strong rapport with the person and he has begun to grow and gain confidence should you address areas of weakness. And then they should be handled gently and one at a time.
Number six, enlarge them one step at a time. Ronald Osborne said, "Unless you try to do something beyond what you have already mastered, you will never grow." The key to enlarging others is to help them take growth steps that stretch them regularly without overwhelming or discouraging them. For each person, that process will look different. But no matter where a person is starting from or where he's going, he needs to grow in certain areas. We suggest that you start by focusing on three areas: attitude, relationships, and leadership. As you help people grow, work from the inside out. It's not what happens to you in life that makes a difference. It's what happens in you.
Number seven, put resources in their hands. This is one of the greatest ways to help people grow. Whenever either John or I meets with someone we're developing, we always try to bring something with us to help enlarge them. Books, tapes, magazine articles, anything we can get our hands on. If you keep putting good resources into people's hands, they will not only love the time they spend with you, but each time you meet, you'll see that they've grown just a little more toward their potential.
Number eight, expose them to enlarging experiences. Putting people on some kind of a plan for growth is a great way to enlarge them. But sometimes they need something more, something that will give them a fresh burst of energy and inspiration. Author and champion for the blind, Helen Keller, said, "One can never consent to creep when one feels an impulse to soar. When you expose people to enlarging experiences, you plant within them that desire to soar, to achieve greatness." Some of the things that are especially good for enlarging people are conferences and seminars, meetings with great men and women, and special events. Those kinds of experiences have made a tremendous impact on us. They always take us from our comfort zone, move us to think beyond ourselves, or challenge us to go to new levels of living.
Number 9, teach them to be self-enlargers. According to Philip B. Crosby, there is a theory of human behavior that says people subconsciously retard their own intellectual growth. They come to rely on clichés and habits. Once they reach the age of their own personal comfort with the world, they stop learning and their mind runs on idle for the rest of their days. They may progress organizationally, they may be ambitious and eager, they may even work night and day, but they learn no more. Once you've gotten people to value growth enough to start enlarging themselves, you've broken through a strong barrier. But the next step is to get them to keep growing on their own. As you work with others and help them to enlarge themselves, give them what they need so that they learn to take care of themselves. Teach them to find resources. Encourage them to get out of their comfort zone. And point them toward additional people who can help them learn and grow. If you can help them to become lifelong learners, you will have given them an incredible gift.
It's been said, no one becomes rich unless he enriches another. When you enrich others by helping them grow and enlarge themselves, you not only bring joy to them and yourself, but you also increase your influence and their ability to touch others' lives. At the beginning of this chapter, Jim told you about how Fernando has enriched the life of his and Nancy's son, Eric. But there's even more to the story than that.
Now, since Eric played in that power soccer tournament, he's really changed. He's become more assertive, and he's pursuing his goals with more enthusiasm. For example, Eric has now decided that he wants to try to play tennis, so Fernando started working with him to get him ready. As I mentioned earlier, Eric's begun weight training, but he's also taken another step to help make tennis possible, a step that at first scared Nancy and me. Since his stroke, Eric's right hand is extremely limited in what it can do, so he really only has full use of his left hand. But to play tennis, he would have to use his good left hand to hold the racket. What was Fernando's solution? He waited until Nancy and I were out of town and switched Eric's wheelchair controls over to his bad hand. We didn't think it was possible. But it was. Eric now drives right-handed, and as soon as he's ready, he's going to take up tennis. Fernando's mentoring and coaching of Eric have been fantastic. It's even enlarged us. We always wanted the best for Eric, but we discovered that we were overly protective. The whole process has broadened our horizons. And of course, it's incredible to see Eric grow and change as he has. But he, Nancy, and I are not alone in that. Even the enlarger has become enlarged. Fernando is also changing and growing, too. He's always been the consummate professional, but we're now seeing a softer, more loving side that was previously hidden. And recently, he told Nancy, "I'm learning that I have to really give to have joy in my life."
What 19th century American philosopher-poet Ralph Waldo Emerson said is true. It is one of the most beautiful compensations of this life, that no man can sincerely try to help another without helping himself. If you give yourself to enlarging others and assisting them in reaching their potential, the rewards you reap will be almost as great as the ones of the people that you help. Chapter number 7. A person of influence navigates for other people. I travel a lot because of the speaking I do around the country, and sometimes that leads to unusual situations. I remember one particular evening when I was in the airport in Charlotte, North Carolina, getting ready to fly to Indianapolis, Indiana. I was on the phone up to the last minute, and then I dashed up to my gate and met Dick Peterson, the president of Enjoy, expecting to run onto the plane just before the door closed. But to my surprise, the waiting area had about 50 or 60 people moping around in it. I looked at Dick and said, "What's going on?" "Well," said Dick, "it looks like we won't get to fly out for a while yet." So I went up and talked to the agent at the gate, and he told me, "The flight attendants aren't here yet, and we can't allow anyone to board until they come." Then he announced the same thing over the PA system, and I could see everyone in the waiting area kind of deflate. People looked miserable. I looked at Dick and I said, "You know, let's see if we can help these people out." So we went out to the snack counter close by, and I told the woman working there, named Denise, "I'd like 60 Coca-Colas, please." She stared at me a moment and finally said, "You want 60?" Then I explained to her, "There are a whole bunch of passengers down at the next gate who are disappointed, and they need something to boost their morale." "You're not kidding. You're going to buy one for everybody?" she asked. "You bet. She paused for a moment and said, "That's great. Can I help?" So she, Dick, and I took those drinks down to the people at the gate, and I could see they weren't sure what to think. So I said, "May I have your attention, please? My name is John Maxwell, and since we're not going to leave for 30 to 45 minutes, I thought I would at least get you something to drink. It's on the house." When we finally got on the plane, I saw a large basket of peanuts, granola bars, and goodies in the galley, and I thought to myself, "Hey, they ought to have something to eat with that Coca-Cola." So I went down the aisle giving out the goodies. In only 5 minutes, I had served them all something to eat, and they were drinking their Cokes. And about this time, the flight crew rushed aboard. They were very apologetic. They got on the plane's PA system right away and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to get started right away, and as soon as we can, we'll begin the beverage service." Well, they could hear a lot of laughter and chattering in the cabin, and one of the flight attendants said to the other, "What's going on here?" "Hi, my name's John," I said. "They're not too worried about your service right now. I've already given everybody something to drink and some snacks to eat. In fact, would it be all right if I talked to everybody for a moment?" They laughed and said, "Sure, why not?" As we taxied out to the runway, they let me talk. "Hi, folks," I said. "This is your friend John Maxwell. Please buckle up. We'll be airborne in a few minutes, and as soon as we're in the air, I'll be back again to serve you." We had a great time on that flight. I talked to everybody and helped serve drinks, and when we landed, I asked if I could talk to the people one more time. "Gang," I said, "this is John. I'm so glad you were on this flight today. Didn't we have a wonderful time?" Everybody clapped and cheered. "Now, when we get off, I'm going to go down to the baggage claim area. If any of you have any problems, please see me, and we'll immediately take care of the situation." While I was down in the baggage area helping people find their luggage, a man came up to me and said, "This has been great. I'm from Florida, and I've got some grapefruit with me. Here, have a grapefruit." "Well, thank you very much," I said. "You know, I've got a brother who lives in Florida, in Winter Haven." "That's where I live," he said. "What's your name again? John Maxwell? Wait, is your brother's name Larry and his wife Anita?" "That's correct." "I know them," he said. "Anita serves on a board with me. I'm going to call them right now. They won't believe it." He hurried off toward a bank of phones. "I've traveled for years," he said, "and nothing like this has ever happened before."
Well, what could have been a miserable plane ride of tired, grumpy people turned out to be an experience that nobody on that flight will ever forget. Why? Because one person decided to take others under his wing and help them through a potentially unpleasant situation. It's a process that we call navigating. Most people need help working through some of life's difficulties. That plane flight probably wasn't more than an inconvenience for most of those passengers, but they still enjoyed being coached through the experience by someone with a good attitude. That kind of assistance is needed and appreciated by most people, especially when life's complicated problems hit closer to home and people have a tougher time with them. The people in your life with whom you have influence need your help, especially the ones who are trying to go to a new level, start a new venture, or enter a new phase of life. They need someone to lead and guide them on a fairly continual basis, at least until they can get their lives together. And then they can be encouraged to make the trip under their own power. It's like an ocean voyage that you have to help them navigate through. You've got to help them find their way, spot icebergs, and weather some pretty stormy seas. And you've got to take the trip with them, at least until they are on the right course and can learn to navigate on their own.
The first quality of a good navigator is that he helps his people identify their destination. In Be the Leader You Were Meant to Be, Leroy Imes says, "A leader is one who sees more than others see, who sees farther than others see, and who sees before others do." In the previous chapter, we talked about the importance of casting a vision of people's future so that they are encouraged to grow. The next step is to show them their destination in a more concrete way. You have got to help others discover their dream and then get them moving toward it. If there is no movement, there can be no navigation. And any movement will only be progress if it's in the direction of their destination. You may already recognize much of the potential of people you're trying to mentor, but you need to know more about them. To help them recognize the destination they will be striving for, you need to know what really matters to them, what makes them tick. To do that, find out these three things. What do they cry about? To know where people truly want to go, you've got to know what touches their hearts. What do they sing about? In the long run, people need to focus a lot of their energy on what gives them joy. Look for enthusiasms in the people that you mentor. What do they dream about? Napoleon Hill said, "Cherish your visions and your dreams as they are the children of your soul, the blueprints of your ultimate achievements." If you can help somebody discover his dream and truly believe in it, you can help him become the person he was designed to be.
The second thing navigators do is plot the course for people. Once you, as the navigator, assist others in identifying a vision for their lives, you need to help them find a way to make it a reality. To help people plot their course in life, start by giving attention to three main areas: where they need to go, what they need to know, and how they need to grow. As you work with people, help them figure out not only their long-term destination, but also the smaller steps they need to take along the way. Help them identify attainable goals that will give them confidence and they'll make progress.
The third thing navigators do is think ahead. Few things in life are more discouraging than being blindsided, especially when someone who could have helped you stands by and watches it happen. That's why one of the greatest things any navigator can do for others is to think ahead for them. As the leader and mentor of others, you have been places they've not yet gone, had experiences they've yet not been through, and gained insights that they've not yet developed. You have the ability to prepare them for what they are going to face.
The fourth characteristic of navigators is that they make course corrections. We've heard that back before the time of sophisticated electronic navigational equipment, ship's navigators used to take a reading of the stars at a particular time in the middle of each night, determine how far off course the vessel was, and make adjustments to its course. No matter how accurately the original course had been laid out, or how carefully the helmsman had followed his orders, the ship always got off course and needed adjustments. People are the same way. No matter how focused they are or how well they plan, people will still get off course. The problem comes when they have difficulty making course corrections, either because they don't know they're off course or they don't know what they should do to fix things. Not everyone is a natural problem solver. For most people, it's a skill they must learn. John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State during the Eisenhower administration, said, "The measure of success is not whether you have a tough problem to deal with, but whether it's the same problem you had last year." As their navigator, you can help them avoid that kind of situation.
Finally, good navigators stay with their people. They don't just give directions and then walk away. They travel alongside their people as friends. As you come alongside some of the people within your influence and begin mentoring them, you and they may experience some very difficult times together. You won't be perfect, and neither will they. But just keep in mind what Henry Ford said: "Your best friend is he who brings out the best that is within you." Do your best to follow that objective, and you will help a lot of people. Jim is an excellent thinker and problem solver. He's navigated through some pretty interesting situations over the years. Recently, he recounted a story that you will undoubtedly enjoy.
A couple of years ago, while Nancy and I were hosting a business seminar aboard a large cruise ship in the Caribbean, we were called away to an important business meeting in Michigan. We had no problem getting to the meeting because arrangements had been made for us to be picked up by a private jet at the airport in San Juan, Puerto Rico. But leaving Michigan and getting back turned out to be quite another story. Our plan was to return on the same jet the next day and meet the ship at its next port. From there, the ship would return to Miami, and we could continue teaching our seminar. But in Michigan, when we began to depart, our aircraft developed a problem and had to return to the hangar. That caused a serious problem for us. There were no commercial flights to our destination, nor were there any private planes with enough range to get us down to St. Martin, which is some 1,500 miles off the coast of Florida. Missing the seminar was simply not an option for us, so we looked at other possibilities. The best we could do was take an available private jet to Atlanta and then work on finding another plane to take us the rest of the way. By the time we touched down in Atlanta, we had managed to arrange for another plane and it was ready and waiting for us. As soon as our plane came to a stop, we gathered up our things and scrambled over to the other jet. You can imagine how relieved we were to get on board and get in the air. We weren't on our way for very long before we found out that our current flight was going to get us on the island exactly 15 minutes after the ship was scheduled to depart. "We've got to get them to delay that ship," I said. The pilot started working on the problem via radio and managed to contact the ship's captain from the cockpit. He agreed to a 20-minute delay. Then the pilot worked on getting us a quick clearance through customs, and when the word came back that we would be able to do it, we started getting optimistic. We dashed to the first taxi we could find and headed out, but almost immediately we hit a huge traffic jam. "How far is it to the ship?" Nancy asked. "It's on the other side of the island," the driver answered. "Well, how long will it take?" "Oh, 15, maybe 20 minutes," he said. "We need to make it in less than 10, I said, offering him a really good tip. He looked at me, he looked at the money, and he said, "Yes, sir." He pulled the cab over onto the sidewalk and made a quick turn up an alley. We went over curbs, through lights, weaved down alleys and side streets in a blur. Felt like we were on Mr. Toad's Wild Ride at Disneyland. Seemed like we saw the back of every building on the island, but then we shot through a narrow opening, between two buildings, careened out into the sunlight, onto a pier, and the ship was in sight, its horn sounding its imminent departure. As we screeched to a halt at the end of the pier, we piled out of the cab. That's when we began to hear the cheering. Evidently, the word had gotten to our people on the ship that we were fighting to make our way back to them. And when we finally had a second to look up, we could see over 500 people on the deck whooping and clapping and cheering to celebrate our arrival. Our driver asked, "Who are you anyway?" I just handed him the money and said, "Thanks for your help." And then Nancy and I ran for the gangway. It hadn't been easy, but we had made it.
The ability to navigate problems and overcome obstacles is a skill that anyone can learn, but it takes practice. If Jim and Nancy had faced the same situation 20 years before, they probably would not have made it to that ship. But over the years, they developed an incredible ability to make things happen, not only in their own lives, but in the lives of others. You can have that same ability. Become a navigator in the lives of others. You will not only be able to use your influence to help them move up to the next level in their lives, but if you assist them during their darkest hours, you will make friends of them for life. Chapter number 8. A person of influence connects with people. My first job out of college in 1969 was a little church in Hillham, Indiana. I was the senior pastor there for 3 years. The church really grew during the short time Margaret and I were there, so much that we had to construct a new church building in 1971 to hold all the people. We look back on those 3 years as a crucial growing time in our lives that we really enjoyed and benefited from. Recently, I got a phone call from that little country church asking me to speak at a big 25th anniversary celebration that they were preparing, and I gladly accepted. I told them, "You just tell me the day and I'll be there." During the next few months, I spent some time thinking about how I could make their anniversary a great day for them. The last thing I wanted to do was to come back as some kind of a conquering hero. I needed to find ways to connect with them. The first thing I did was get them to send me a copy of their church directory with pictures and names of all the people in their congregation. There in the book were many faces I recognized. Some people had less hair than I remembered, and much of that hair was now gray. But I knew those faces behind those 25 years of wrinkles. And there were many others who were new to me, sons and daughters of people I loved, and some new names that I didn't recognize. I spent many hours poring over those pictures and memorizing those names. Then I prepared the best message I could, one filled with stories of our common experiences. I shared some of my mistakes and recounted all of their victories. I wanted them to know that they shared in my success. They were kingmakers, and I felt very privileged to have served them for 3 years and benefited from their loving support and care for me. But I knew that more important than the message I preached or anything else I could do would be the time I was able to spend with the people. So when the time came, Margaret and I flew in early, and we spent Saturday afternoon with some of the old-timers who had been such a vital part of our ministry 25 years before. We shared a lot of wonderful recollections. I talked to them about some of my fondest memories, and they surprised me with a few stories of their own. For instance, there was one man in a wheelchair who had been a teenager when I was a pastor there. He had been in an accident that left him in a coma. I had visited him and his family several times in the hospital, and one night I shared my faith with him as he lay unconscious in his bed. I left Hillham soon afterward to go to my next church, and until my current visit, I hadn't known that he had ever awakened from the coma. Do Do you remember coming into the hospital and talking to me 25 years ago? He asked. I sure do, I answered. So do I, he told me. I remember that day as clear as can be. I wasn't able to answer you, but I heard every word you said. That's the day I became a believer. And he told me about how his faith had impacted other people in the community. It was a very special time. The next day, I got to church early to shake hands with the people as they came into the sanctuary. It was wonderful to get to meet so many people and be able to greet them by name. And I preached a message of affirmation to them. Even though they had done some wonderful things since I had last seen them, I told them that I could see that in the next 25 years lay their greatest potential. Their best days were still ahead of them. And when I left, I felt as though I had not only renewed some old acquaintances, but made a lot of new friends.
The time John got to spend with the people in Hillham was brief, but in that short period he was able to do something that was important to both them and himself. He was able to connect with them. Connection is a very important part of the process of mentoring others, and it's absolutely critical if you want to influence people in a positive way. When you navigate for others, you come alongside them and travel their road for a while, helping them handle some of the obstacles and difficulties they have in their lives. But when you connect with them, you're asking them to come alongside you and travel your road for both your and their mutual benefit. To learn how to connect with people, listen to the following 9 steps.
Number 1, don't take people for granted. You can only connect with people and lead them if you value them. Weak leaders sometimes get so caught up in the vision of where they're going that they forget the people they're trying to lead. But you can't take people for granted for any length of time and be a successful leader. Valuing people is the first important step in the connection process. When you let people know that you don't take them for granted and value them, they turn around and do the same for you. I was recently reminded of this by my friend and colleague, Dan Ryland. Margaret and I spent a long weekend with Dan and his wife, Patty, not too long ago. Dan has worked with me for 15 years, first as my executive pastor at Skyline Church, where I was the senior pastor there, and now he's the vice president at Enjoy. We spent the weekend at a resort hotel in Laguna Beach. It was great. We enjoyed the pool and spa and ate some great meals and had a wonderful time together. As Margaret and I were checking out, I went to the front desk to pay the bill and discovered that Dan had beaten me there and had already taken care of everything. Later, I talked to him and said, "Dan, you didn't have to do that. I wanted to treat you and Patty." "No, John," said Dan. "It was our pleasure. You do so much for us. I never want to take you for granted."
Number 2, possess a make-a-difference mindset. If you desire to accomplish something great and really want to be able to see it happen, you need to possess a make-a-difference attitude. Anytime you don't believe that you can make a difference, you won't. How do you cultivate a solid make-a-difference mindset? First, believe you can make a difference. Second, believe what you share can make a difference. Third, believe the person you share with can make a difference. And fourth, believe that together you can make a big difference. Mother Teresa said, "I can do what you can't do, and you can do what I can't do. Together we can do great things." No one ever achieves alone what he can do when partnering with others. If you want to connect with people and take them with you to a higher level, recognize the difference you can make as a team and acknowledge it at every opportunity.
Number 3, initiate movement toward them. According to Tom Peters and Nancy Austin, the number 1 managerial productivity problem in America is, quite simply, managers who are out of touch with their people and out of touch with their customers. Lack of contact and communication is a problem that affects many people today, not just managers and organizations. We believe there are many reasons why people don't connect with one another more than they do. One of the main reasons, especially within organizations, is that many leaders believe that it is the followers' responsibility to initiate contact with them. But the opposite is actually true. To be effective, a leader must be an initiator. If he doesn't go to his people, meet them where they are, and initiate the connection, then 80% of the time no connection will ever be made.
Number 4, look for common ground. Anytime you want to connect with another person, the place to start is where you both agree. And that means finding common ground. If you've developed good listening skills, as we talked about in Chapter 4, you'll probably be able to detect areas where you have common experience or views. As it's sometimes said, all things being equal, people will do business with people they like. All things not being equal, they still will.
Number 5, recognize and respect differences in personality. While we are capable of finding common ground with others, at the same time we need to acknowledge that we are all different. And that's one of the great joys of life. John Luther said, "Natural talent, intelligence, a wonderful education, none of these guarantees success. Something else is needed. The sensitivity to understand what others want and the willingness to give it to them. Pay attention to people's personalities and do your best to meet them where they are. They'll appreciate your sensitivity and understanding."
Number 6, find the key to others' lives. Industrialist Andrew Carnegie had an uncanny ability for understanding people and what was important to them. It's said that when he was a boy in Scotland, he had a rabbit that had a litter of bunnies. In order to feed them, Carnegie asked the neighborhood boys to collect clover and dandelions. In return, each boy would get to name a bunny after himself. Carnegie did something similar as an adult that also showed his understanding of people. Because he wanted to sell his steel to the Pennsylvania Railroad, when he built a new steel mill in Pittsburgh, he named it the J. Edgar Thompson Steel Works, after the president of Pennsylvania Railroad. Thompson was so flattered by the honor that he thereafter purchased all his steel from Carnegie. You don't have to be a Carnegie to connect with people. You just need to know what's important to them. Everybody has a key to his or her life. All you need to do is find it. Here are 2 clues to help you do it. To understand a person's mind, examine what he has already achieved. To understand his heart, look at what he aspires yet to do. That will help you find the key. And once you do find it, use it with integrity. Turn the key only when you have the person's permission, and even then use that key only for his benefit, not your own, to help and not to hurt.
Number 7, communicate from the heart. Once you've initiated a connection with others, found common ground, and discovered what really matters to them, it's important to communicate to them what really matters to you. And that requires that you speak to them from your heart. Being genuine is the single most important factor when communicating with others, whether one-to-one or before large audiences. No amount of knowledge, technique, or quick-wittedness can substitute for honesty and the genuine desire to help others. So as you communicate with others to build connections with them, share from your heart and be yourself.
Number 8, share common experiences. To really connect with others, you have to do more than find common ground and communicate well. You need to find a way to cement the relationship. Joseph F. Newton said, "People are lonely because they build walls instead of bridges." The best way to build bridges that connect you to people in a lasting way is to share common experiences with them. The two of us have enjoyed sharing experiences with others for years. For example, whenever John hires a new member of his executive staff, he always takes that person on the road with him to several of his conferences. He does that not only because he wants that new staff member to become familiar with what kind of services the company offers to its customers, but also so that they can travel together and get to know one another in a wide variety of settings. Nothing bonds people together like racing through impossible traffic in an unfamiliar city to get to the airport and then running with your bags down the concourse to scramble into a plane at the last minute. The common experiences you share with others don't have to be that dramatic, although adversity is definitely good at bringing people together. Share meals with people. Go to a ball game together. Take people out on a call or visitation with you. Anything you experience together that creates a common history helps to connect you to others. Look for ways to build bridges with people within your influence, especially during times when they are experiencing adversity. The connections you make will strengthen your relationships incredibly and prepare you for the journey you can take together.
Number 9, once connected, move forward. If you want to influence others and you desire to get them moving in the right direction, it's crucial that you connect with them before you try to take them anywhere. Attempting to move people without first connecting with them is a common mistake that inexperienced leaders often make. It often results in mistrust, resistance, and strained relationships. Always remember that you have to share yourself before you try to share the journey. As someone once said, leadership is cultivating in people today a future willingness on their part to follow you into something new for the sake of something great. Connection creates that willingness. One of the greatest challenges any influencer faces is connecting with people from another culture. Jim has had a lot of experience in this area since he works with people in 26 different countries. He found it particularly interesting working with people in the Eastern Bloc countries formerly controlled by the Soviet Union.
And when we first started working with people in Eastern Europe, it was really a unique experience. We had very little exposure to their culture and values, and we found that things we accept in everyday business were foreign to people who had endured 50 years of communist rule. Most people in America have been raised on Judeo-Christian ethical and moral values. We often take that for granted, along with the benefits of free enterprise and capitalism. Our new friends in countries like Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic, however, were used to surviving in a corrupt world of oppressive government, propaganda, and little or no ethical teaching as we know it. Their environment led them to believe that success comes only to those who work around the rules and beat the cheaters at their own game. We found that many people embraced a success-at-any-cost mindset and almost a pride in how cleverly they could break the rules. We believed it was important to show these wonderful people that real success was only possible when a person behaved ethically and stood on the principles of integrity and trust. It seemed like a big job, but the people were smart, and we were working with some great young professionals who were hungry to learn the secrets of true success. We began the process by doing everything we could to connect with people in those countries. We were able to find a few key people, and we came alongside them as friends and mentors, navigating them through this new paradigm of ethical living and principle-centered business. And we invested a lot of time in getting to know them better and connecting with them on this worthwhile journey. Our goal was to give them tools to positively impact the people in their country. This is still an ongoing journey for us, but whether we are working with people in Eastern Europe, mainland China, or another part of the world, we recognize that people are basically the same. Everyone wants to be successful and happy and is eager to learn from others who have gone ahead of them. But you can't make a significant impact in people's lives until you personally connect with them. Only then can you take them on a journey and really make a difference.
Jim and Nancy are making an impact that is being felt around the world. They understand that influence means relating to people, raising them up, and then turning them loose to reproduce themselves in others' lives. Connecting is an important step in that process. But before people can go to the highest level and reproduce their influence in others, there is one more important step that they need to take. First, they need to be empowered, and that is the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 9, A Person of Influence Empowers People. A big part of Jim's business includes meeting fairly often with some of his key leaders, and because those people come from around the country and all over the world, he makes it a goal to schedule those meetings in various locations. One place that's become a favorite of his and Nancy's over the years is Deer Valley near Salt Lake City, Utah. Recently, when they were there with some of their leaders, something interesting happened. Jim will tell you about it.
Yeah, Deer Valley is really a beautiful setting. In the winter, it's great for skiing, and in the summer, it's got gorgeous forested mountains and meadows full of wildflowers. We really enjoy vacationing there and using it as a place to meet with some of our people. This past year, we spent time with a group of about 10 couples at some condos in Deer Valley right on the ski slopes. We had a wonderful time. When we were ready to leave, we packed up our belongings and swung by the rental office to check out on the way to the airport. But as we worked to get our bill squared away, we discovered that one couple in our party had inadvertently left their room key back at their condo. "I'm going to have to charge you $25 for the lost key," the desk clerk said. I have to admit I was a little surprised. We had been their customers for 8 years, and we had spent thousands of dollars with them in the past week. "Look," I said, "I appreciate that you have a policy about missing keys, but the key is in their room, and if we were to go back and get it, we'd miss our flight. Can't you just forget the charge?" "No," he said. "The rule is that I have to add the charge to your bill." Even when I reminded him of our history with the company and told him that I didn't feel good about extra charge, he wouldn't budge. In fact, he just got more rigid, and I finally got really irritated. As I stood there waiting, I calculated in my mind how much money we had spent there over the years, and I figured that he was jeopardizing our $100,000 history with their company for a $25 key. We finally left and paid the fee. On our way to the airport, Nancy and I talked about the incident, and I thought about how it really wasn't the desk clerk's fault. The problem was with the owner, who had failed to train him properly. "That kind of thing drives me crazy," she said. "Some people just don't get it. You know who's just the opposite of that," she said. "Nordstrom. They're unbelievable. I didn't tell you about what happened the other night before we left for Deer Valley. I went down to Nordstrom's to get Eric a pair of pajamas. I picked out some that I knew he'd like, but I told the sales girl that I needed the pants hemmed and that we were leaving on a trip early the next morning. She didn't blink and offered to have them done that night and drive them out to us at our home. And that was the only thing I bought," added Nancy. "It's not like I had spent a lot of money. She did that just for a pair of pajamas."
Stories of the great service at Nordstrom department stores have become legendary. Anyone who shops there can attest to it. The reason their employees are exceptional is that the company is built on the principle of empowerment. That philosophy of empowering employees is capsulized in the following brief statement, which every employee receives when he or she begins working for the company. Welcome to Nordstrom. We're glad to have you with our company. Our number one goal is to provide outstanding customer service. Set both your personal and professional goals high. We have great confidence in your ability to achieve them. Nordstrom rules. Rule number one, use your good judgment in all situations. There will be no additional rules. Please feel free to ask your department manager, store manager, or division general manager any question at any time. People are the emphasis at Nordstrom, not policies. The ability to empower others is one of the keys to personal and professional success. Millionaire business executive J. Paul Getty said, "It doesn't make much difference how much other knowledge or experience an executive possesses. If he is unable to achieve results through people, he is worthless as an executive." When you become an empowerer, you certainly work with people and through people, but you also do much more. You enable people to reach the highest levels in their personal and professional development. Simply defined, empowering is giving your influence to others for the purpose of personal and organizational growth. It's sharing yourself, your influence, position, power, and opportunities with others with the purpose of investing in the lives of others so that they can function at their best. It's seeing people's potential, sharing your resources with them, and showing others you believe in them completely. You may already be empowering some people in your life without even knowing it. When you entrust your spouse with an important decision and then cheerfully back him up, that's empowering. When you decide that your child is ready to cross the street by himself and give him your permission to do so, you've empowered him. When you delegate a challenging job to an employee and give her the authority she needs to get it done, you've empowered her. The act of empowering others changes lives, and one of the greatest things about it is that it's a win-win for you and for the people you empower. Giving others your authority isn't like giving them an object, like your car, for example. If you give away your car, you're stuck without transportation. But if you empower others by giving them your authority, it has the same effect as sharing information. You haven't lost anything. You've increased the ability of others without decreasing yourself. Qualifications of an empowerer. Just about everyone has the potential to become an empowerer, but you cannot empower everyone. The process works only when certain conditions are met. To empower others, you must first have position. You can't empower people that you don't lead. Second, you must have a relationship with the people you empower. The third requirement for empowering others is respect. Relationships cause people to want to be with you, but respect causes them to want to be empowered by you. The last quality a leader needs in order to become an empowerer is commitment. As U.S. Air Executive Ed McElroy said, commitment gives us new power. No matter what comes to us, sickness, poverty, or disaster, we never turn our eye from the goal.
How to empower others to their potential. Once you've established that you meet the qualifications of an empowerer, you're ready to get the process started. Your goal should be to hand over relatively small, simple tasks in the beginning and progressively increase the other person's responsibilities and authority. The greener the person you're working with, the more time the process will take. But no matter whether the person is a raw recruit or a seasoned veteran, it's still important to take him through the whole process. Use the following steps to guide you as you empower others.
Number one, evaluate them. You need to know where people are before you will be able to begin empowering them. With inexperienced people, if you give them too much authority too soon, you can be setting them up to fail. With people who have lots of experience, if you move too slowly, you can frustrate and demoralize them. Sometimes when leaders misjudge the capabilities of others, the results can be comical. For example, we once read about an incident from the life of Albert Einstein that illustrates this point. In 1898, Einstein applied for admittance at the Munich Technical Institute and was rejected because he would never amount to much. As a result, instead of going to school, he worked as an inspector at the Swiss Patent Office in Bern. And with the extra time that he had on his hands, he worked at refining and writing up his theory of relativity. Remember, all people have the potential to succeed within them. Your job is to see the potential, find out what they lack to develop them, and equip them with what they need.
Number two, model for them. Even people with knowledge, skill, and desire need to know what's expected of them, and the best way to inform them is to show them. People do what people see. Model the attitude and work ethic you would like them to embrace. And any time you can include them in your work, take them along with you. There's no better way to help them learn and understand what you want them to do.
Number three, give them permission to succeed. As a leader and influencer, you may believe that everyone strives to be successful, but not everyone you influence will think the same way you do. You have to help them not only believe that they can succeed, but also show them that you want them to succeed. Back it up not only with what you say, but what you do. Once people recognize and understand that you genuinely want them to succeed and are committed to helping them, they will begin to believe that they can accomplish what you give them to do.
Number four, transfer authority to them. The real heart of empowerment is the transfer of your authority and influence to the people you are mentoring and developing. Many people are willing to give others responsibility. They gladly delegate tasks to them. But empowering others is more than simply sharing your workload. It's sharing your power and ability to get things done. As you begin to empower your people, start by giving them challenges you know they can rise to meet and conquer. It will not only make them confident, but it will give them a chance to try out their new authority and learn to use it wisely. And once they've begun to be effective, continue to give them more difficult assignments. A good rule of thumb is that if someone else can do a job 80% as well as you, delegate it. In the end, your goal is to empower others so well that they become capable of meeting nearly any challenge that comes their way. And in time, they will develop their own influence with others so that they no longer require yours to be effective.
Number five, show your confidence in them publicly. When you first transfer authority to the people you empower, you need to tell them that you believe in them and you need to do it publicly. Public recognition lets them know that you believe that they will succeed. But it also does something else. It lets the people they're working with know that they have your support and that your authority backs them up. It's a tangible way of sharing and spreading your influence. I mentioned in the last chapter that Dan Ryland has worked with me for 15 years. When Dan first started with me, he was an intern fresh out of graduate school. He had a lot of talent, but he still had some rough edges. I worked with him quite a bit, modeling, motivating, and mentoring him. And in a short time, he grew to be a first-rate leader. In just a few years, he became one of my key players. When we had a new program that needed to be created and implemented, I frequently looked to Dan, empowered him to take on the task, and gave him my full confidence and authority. And he took care of it. Time after time, I'd give him a major project. He would work through the whole process, implement it, raise up leaders to run it, and then come back to me for another task. He continually worked himself out of a job. In 1989, about 6 or 7 years after Dan began working for me, I came to a point where I realized I needed to hire an executive pastor, a kind of chief administrative officer, and I knew right away that I wanted Dan to fill the position. Now, I knew that when you raise up a leader from within the ranks, there is often resentment and resistance from some of the person's colleagues, but I had a strategy. As I began to transfer my authority to Dan, I tried my best not to miss an opportunity to publicly praise him, show my confidence in him, and remind everyone that Dan spoke with my authority. As a result, the rest of the staff quickly rallied around him, and he was empowered as their new leader. As you raise up leaders, show them and their followers that they have your confidence and authority, and you will find that they quickly become empowered to succeed.
Number 6, supply them with feedback. While you need to give your people lots of praise publicly, you can't let them go very long without giving them honest, positive feedback. Meet with them privately to coach them through their mistakes, miscues, and misjudgments. At first, some people may have a difficult time. During that early period, be a grace giver. Try to give them what they need, not what they deserve, and applaud any progress that they make. People do what gets praised.
Number 7, release them to continue on their own. No matter who you are working to empower, whether it's your employees, children, colleagues, or spouse, your ultimate aim should be to release them to make good decisions and succeed on their own. And that means giving them as much freedom as possible as soon as they are ready for it. President Abraham Lincoln was a master at empowering his leaders. For example, when he appointed General Ulysses S. Grant as commander of the Union armies in 1864, he sent him a message which read, "I neither ask nor desire to know anything of your plans. Take the responsibility and act, and call on me for assistance." That's the kind of attitude you need to have as an empowerer. Give authority and responsibility and offer assistance as needed. If you head up any kind of organization, a business, club, church, or even family, learning to empower others is one of the most important things you'll ever do as a leader. Empowerment has an incredibly high return. It not only helps the individuals you raise up by making them more confident, energetic, and productive, but it also has the ability to improve your life, give you additional freedom, and promote the growth and health of your organization.
When it comes down to it, empowering leadership is sometimes the only real advantage one organization has over another in our competitive society. As you begin to empower others, you will find that just about every aspect of your life will change for the better. Empowering others can free you personally to have more time for the important things in your life, increase the effectiveness of your organization, increase your influence with others, and, best of all, make an incredibly positive impact on the lives of the people you empower.
Jim recently received a letter from someone he has spent several years motivating, mentoring, and empowering. His name is Mitch Sala, and here's his letter. "Dear Jim, I know you are in the process of writing a book on influence, and I feel the need to put pen to paper to express my deep respect and love for you and Nancy and tell you about the profound impact you've had on my life. Your influence on me started before we even met when I listened to one of your tapes for the first time. Your vision, positive attitude, and committed faith were inspiring, and Nancy's ability to put life and its obstacles in proper perspective helped me to see my world in a new way. As I observed you, I sensed an incredible depth of character in you. I admired that and wanted it myself. It made me want to get to know you better and develop our relationship. I had never really developed close friendships before, so that was new for me. You see, I grew up in Africa where my father ran a large sawmill in the forest. My older brother and sister were away at school, so I pretty much grew up without other kids around. I was kind of a loner. When I was 8, they sent me to traditional boarding school. It was good for my education, but bad for my self-image. It left me feeling like a loser. As an adult, those feelings drove me to work hard and try to prove myself, but I still felt empty no matter what I did, and I was failing at the things that mattered to me most, being a good husband and father. But you became an influence in my life at just the right time. You understood me and made me feel accepted despite my mistakes and failings. You've helped me to grow in my family life, financially and spiritually. Everything has changed in my life. Signed, Mitch. Jim's positive influence has helped Mitch Sala change his life. Jim has taken him through the entire process. He's modeled a life of integrity to him. He's motivated and mentored him. He's empowered him. And over the years, Mitch has become a world-class influencer himself. Through his business enterprises and public speaking, Mitch touches the lives of hundreds of thousands of people every year in over 20 countries around the world. And best of all, he's using his influence to raise up more leaders who are learning how to positively impact the lives of many more people. He's reproduced his influence in others, which is the subject of our final chapter. Chapter 10, A Person of Influence Reproduces Other Influencers. At the beginning of this book, we told you about influencers and specifically about some of the people who have made an impact on our lives, people like Glenn Leatherwood, who is my Sunday school teacher in the 7th grade, and Jerry and Patty Beaumont, who took Jim and Nancy under their wing around the time that Eric was born. Our lives have been filled with wonderful people of influence, but the greatest value has been added to our lives by people who've not only influenced us, but made influencers of us. In my case, that was my father. He has shaped and molded me the most, helping me to become a leader. And in the case of Jim, that place is probably held by Rich DeVos.
I grew up in a great family. We had lots of love, even though there wasn't much money. My father's views on politics and economics were pretty liberal, and his advice to me was to go to college and get a good job. But when I was in my 20s, I heard Rich DeVos speak for the first time, and I was mesmerized. He introduced me to a whole new paradigm. He talked about free enterprise, the worth of the individual, dreams, freedom, and compassionate capitalism. He also talked about his faith in God and encouraged people to live with integrity and passion. I had never before heard any philosophy that made so much sense as his simple message of personal achievement. I was forever changed.
Today, of course, Rich DeVos is one of the most influential businessmen in the world. He is a founder and past president of Amway. He owns the NBA's Orlando Magic. He is the president of Gospel Films and the DeVos Foundation, and he is frequently asked to give advice on business matters to presidents and other influential leaders. Jim has looked up to him not only as a leader and mentor, but over the years, he has also come to call Rich his friend. One of the things Rich DeVos understands is the value of raising up leaders, people who are able to become influencers in their own right. In some ways, teaching others to become leaders is like handing off the baton in a relay race, if you run well yourself, but are unable to pass the baton to another runner, you've lost the race. But if you run well, recruit and train other good runners, and learn to hand off the baton smoothly, you can win. And when it comes to influence, if you can do that process repeatedly, you can multiply your influence. The power of multiplication. In the kind of work with people that the two of us have done, we've had to learn to hand off the baton. We never could have been successful if we hadn't. And now we want to hand it off to you. If you've moved successfully through the influence process, you've learned how to run the race. And if you've mentored others, you've got them now running too. But it's time to pass the baton. And if you don't get it into their hands, the race is over. They'll have no reason to keep running, and the momentum will die with them.
That's why it's so important to go into the reproduction phase of becoming a person of influence. John had the opportunity in 1995 to see exactly how an organization reacts when its leader leaves after equipping and empowering many strong leaders within it. Following 14 years of leading and reproducing leaders at Skyline Wesleyan Church, John resigned from his position as senior pastor. He left so that he could devote himself full-time to Enjoy, his organization that offers seminars and materials for leadership growth and personal development. And the result of his move? Skyline is doing very well. In fact, about a year after John left, he received a note from Janie Hansen, an Enjoy employee whose husband Brad was on staff at Skyline. The note said, "Dear John, I was just thinking about Skyline and how it is really thriving since you left. It's such an absolute tribute to the kind of leadership and lay ministry that you developed. We have a living example of the saying, 'Practice what you preach,' unfolding as we see the fruit of your labor. I can tell anyone without question that the principles you teach work. I can think of no greater honor than that a man pour his life into something, leave, and have it flourish. What a shame it would have been to have a ministry die on the vine when one man leaves. Thank you for pouring your life into us. Signed, your friend, Janie." Mentoring people and developing their leadership potential really can make a huge difference for your organization, for your people, and for you.
We believe that our country is experiencing a leadership crisis today. Not long ago, we saw an article in the New Republic that addressed that issue. In part, it said, 200 years ago, a little republic on the edge of the wilderness suddenly produced people like Jefferson, Hamilton, Madison, Adams, and others. Yet the total population was only 3 million people. Today we have over 200 million. Where are the great people? We should have 60 Franklins in a cover story on leadership. The search was in vain. Ralph Nader, consumer advocate and founder of the Center for Responsive Law, said, "The function of a leader is to produce more leaders, not more followers." Maybe 200 years ago, people understood that better. But today, producing leaders isn't a priority for many people. Besides, developing other leaders isn't always easy or simple. That's why it's important for a person who wants to raise up other leaders to be committed to the task. We've said it before and we'll repeat it here. Everything rises and falls on leadership. When you raise up and empower leaders, you positively impact yourself, your organization, the people you develop, and all the people their lives touch. Reproducing leaders is the most important task of any person of influence. If you want to make an impact, you've got to be committed to developing leaders.
Moving from maintenance to multiplication. Many people live life in maintenance mode. Their main goal is to make it through the day, to keep from losing ground rather than trying to make progress. But that's the lowest level of living when it comes to the development of people. If you want to make an impact, you must strive to become a multiplier. Listen to the five stages that exist between maintenance and multiplication, starting with the lowest. Level 1. Scramble. About 20% of all leaders live on the lowest level in the development process. They are not doing anything to develop people in their organization, and as a result, their attrition rate is off the charts. They just can't seem to keep anyone they recruit. That's why we say they're in the scramble stage. They spend most of their time scrambling to find people to replace the ones they lose. The morale in their organization stays low, and it doesn't take long for them to burn out from exhaustion. Level 2. Survival. The next lowest stage in the development ladder is survival mode. In it, leaders do nothing to develop their people, but they do manage to keep the people they have. About 50% of all organizational leaders function this way. Their organizations are average, their employees are unsatisfied, and no one is developing his potential. No one really benefits from this approach to leadership. Everyone merely survives from day to day without much promise or hope for the future. Level 3. Siphon. About 10% of all leaders work at developing their people into better leaders, but they neglect to build their relationships with their people. As a result, their potential leaders leave the organization to pursue other opportunities. In other words, they are siphoned off from the organization. That often leads to a great deal of frustration on the part of the leader because other people benefit from his effort, and he must spend a lot of time looking for replacements. Level 4. Synergy. When a leader builds strong relationships, develops people to become good leaders, empowers them to reach their potential, and is able to keep them in his organization, something wonderful begins to happen. It's often called synergy, meaning the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, because the parts interact so well together and create energy, progress, and momentum. An organization on the synergy level has great morale and high job satisfaction. Everyone benefits. Only about 19% of all leaders reach this level, but those who do are often considered the very best there are. Number 5, significance. Many people who reach the synergy level of development never try to go any further because they don't realize there is one more step they can take in the development process, and that's to the significance level. That's where leaders develop and reproduce leaders who not only stay in the organization and work to reach their potential, but in turn develop leaders themselves. And that's where influence really multiplies. Only about 1% of all leaders make it to this level, but the ones who do are able to tap into almost limitless growth and influence potential. A handful of leaders continually functioning on the significance level can really make an impact on the world.
So now you know what it means to become a person of influence, to positively impact the lives of others. Jim and I desire for this to always stay with you. So we have developed an acrostic off the word influencer that will help you to always remember how to positively influence the lives of others. Being an influencer means, letter I, modeling integrity with everyone you come into contact with. Letter N, nurturing the people in your life to make them feel valued. The letter F, showing faith in others so that they can believe in themselves. The letter L, listening to them so that you can build your relationship with them. The letter U, understanding them so that you can help them achieve their dreams. The letter E, enlarging them in order to increase their potential. The letter N, navigating them through life's difficulties until they can do it themselves. The letter C, connecting with them so that you can move them to a higher level. The letter E, empowering them to become the person that they were created to be. And finally, letter R, reproducing other leaders so that your influence continues to grow through others. Over the years, Jim and I have worked hard to make this process more than a mere set of principles or a method of working. We've sought to make investing in others a way of living. And as time goes by, we keep working to become better developers of people. Our reward is seeing the impact we make on the lives of others.
One of the greatest things about becoming a person of influence is that you actually get to see the lives of others change before your eyes. John told you in the previous chapter about Mitch Sala, whom I got to see blossom into a person of impact. But Mitch has become more than just an influencer. He has gone through the entire development process himself and now is a great reproducer of influencers too. One of his greatest success stories is a man named Robert Ankasa. Robert is from Indonesia. He holds an MBA from Sydney University and used to work for Citibank, where he had risen up to become a vice president in Jakarta by the time he was 30 years old. Robert has always worked hard. He put himself through school driving a taxi, working in restaurant kitchens and cleaning stadiums after concerts. But a few years ago, he met Mitch Sala. Mitch took Robert under his wing, motivated him, mentored him, and empowered him to become a person of influence himself. Robert says, "The turning point in my life came when I met Mitch. At first, all I noticed was that he was a kind person. But the more time I spent with him, the more I realized that I wanted to be like him while still being myself. Mitch taught me that the way to success was through integrity and hard work. Today, I am tasting the sweetness of a new life. I enjoy the financial security that's come from hard work, but more than that, I am becoming a better person. The pleasure that I get from helping others is enormous, and it gives me great satisfaction. I'm a better person, husband, and family man. I owe a lot of who I am today to Mitch. He is a mentor, a friend, and a parent. I thank God every day for all his blessings that I've received through Mitch. And what I'm trying to do now is to be to others what he's been to me. I want to help others have a better life. The words thank you don't seem sufficient, but they're the best words I can find."
Today, Robert impacts the lives of thousands of people throughout Indonesia, Malaysia, China, and the Philippines. He is one of several key leaders that Mitch is now mentoring. And Robert's influence is continuing to increase daily. My friend, you have the same potential as Robert Ankasa, Mitch Sala, or Jim Dornan. You can become a person of influence and impact the lives of many people. But the decision is yours. You can either develop your influence potential or let it remain unrealized. Jim gave the baton to Mitch. Mitch found Robert and taught him to run. He's successfully given the baton to Robert, and now he is running. There's one more leg, and the baton is ready. Now's your chance. Reach out your hand, take the baton, and finish the race that only you can run. Become a person of influence and change your world.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.